Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the March 18th, 2014 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please, folks, find seats. We'd like to remind you to please silence any cell phones or electronic devices and remind you that there are exits to my right in the back corner and to my left in the front corner. First item tonight we deal with is a public hearing. And it's a public hearing, I'll read the notice, will be held in the Tompkins County Legislature at 5:30 p.m. in Legislature Chambers concerning proposed Local Law A of 2014, a local law enacting Section 470 of the Real Property Tax Law, providing for an exemption from the county taxes for up to 10 years for construction of buildings meeting LEED LEED standards. And we will open it up. Is there anyone like to speak on the proposed local law? Go ahead, step to the microphone. Is that your hand up, sir?
Oh, no. I...
Sir, did you want to speak about this?
No.
Oh, all right. Not seeing anybody who wants to speak on this, we'll adjourn the public hearing.
Yes.
This is on LEED. You're, please step to the phone or to the microphone and speak to it and tell us your name and your municipality.
Thank you. Joanne Cipolla Dennis in Dryden. Yes, I wanted to speak on the LEED certification and your tax exemption. I think it's really important to give not only tax incentives to LEED-qualified buildings, but to also think in the future that we want to create buildings that have LEED qualifications but not incur the amount of the money it costs to actually get that stamp. So if in the future you could talk about, after you pass this, which I hope that you do, to invite companies, builders in to go over what actually is LEED qualified and find a way in the future to eliminate that cost of the stamp and maybe have your own city code officials become so familiar with that that they could actually act as a LEED. You know, they could say, you've met the qualifications for LEED. Although you didn't pay for the stamp, we're going to qualify you anyway. So please consider that. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak about the local law?
Yes.
Go ahead, step to the microphone. Please tell us your name and your municipality.
Yes, I'm Lou Derland, and I live in the town of Ithaca. And actually, I had something that I thought that I had sent today. It didn't seem to go through to the email address. I've got it printed, and I'll leave it for you, too. But I'm here tonight in support of the proposed local law that would provide an exemption from county real estate, county real property taxes for newly constructed or the renovated portions of buildings that meet LEED certification standards. However, I do suggest making some edits to the proposed law that would clarify and strengthen it. First of all, I proposed changing the wording in Section 1, legislative intent, to read now that, quote, it is the intent of this local law to provide an exemption from county real property taxes for new constructed or the renovated portion of buildings that achieve LEED certification. And in the second part, also just say an exemption shall be granted from county tax purposes based on the scale below, which is the scale that you have in the law, for projects that achieve LEED certification. The distinction between the wording meeting LEED standards and achieve certification is important. LEED certification is verified by the Green Building Certification Institute, which is an independent third party that thoroughly reviews the project and holds the building owners accountable for the claims of energy and water performance optimization, improvement of indoor environmental quality, protection and enhancement of sites of water quality resources and human health. Through a pretty rigorous process that the LEED process is intended to do. Some building owners have opted to circumvent this LEED certification process and construct projects that they claim are LEED certifiable or built to LEED standards. So without this third-party verification, there's no way to trust that a particular project has actually met the performance standards of LEED. I also suggest considering that you expand this local law, proposed law, to include entire developments that achieve LEED certification per the LEED for Neighbor Development Rating System, which rewards entire neighborhoods or communities that are built to achieve LEED certification. These are the kinds of projects that are good for residential, non-residential, or mixed-use developments, neighborhoods, campuses, like, and I know this wouldn't really pertain to a college campus since those are already tax-exempt, or like hospital campuses, something like that. But I wanted to just close by saying that I strongly support this. There are new, significant, updated, improved versions of the LEED rating standard or rating system called LEED V4 that make it this new version is really holistic in its approach. It's very performance-based, and it defines goals and projected outcomes in very positive language that, you know, essentially is the pushing as U.S. Green Building Council is trying to do and is really doing, making the next step with the standard, pushing with continuous improvement to push the market beyond net zero and to look for eventually buildings that produce net positive impacts on the environment. And I just wanted to say I'm licensed engineer, certified energy manager, a LEED AP. I've served and continue to serve on the U.S. Green Building Council's New York Upstate Chapter leadership, and I'm happy to work with the legislature and the county to see the successful enactment of this law and promote the construction of sustainable development. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ma'am, would you state your name and your municipality, please?
Barbara Coleman. I'm chair of the Human Rights Commission. I live in Enfield. And we have presented you with 11 candidates, applicants, for the 11 open positions on the commission. And I want to tell you, I am in awe.
Could I interrupt and say right now we're taking comments on a local law? This is a public hearing. We'll be having privilege of the floor in a few minutes. If you could
For
us just a few minutes.
Okay. I thought I was late. So. Okay.
Thank you. Any other comments on our local law? All right. Then I'm going to close the public hearing. And we'll open the regular meeting. Would you please stand with me and pledge allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. May we have the roll call, please?
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
Here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera will be late this evening. Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
13 members present.
We have a quorum?
Yes.
Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I want to announce that we will have an executive session tonight at the end of the meeting to discuss labor negotiations. And also want to mention that I think that's the thing I wanted to mention, come to think about it. Let's move to privilege of the floor for the public. I have three blue cards at this point, I guess four. The first one I have is Sophie Zappala. Our clerk keeps time up here and will let you know when you approach the end of your 3 minutes.
Thank you. My name is Sophie Zappala, and I'm a West Hill resident. Tonight, I would like to address one particular aspect of the Biggs property sale you approved on October 1st, 2013, and that is the price. To date, we have not been able to establish who set the price and on what basis. Do any of you know the market value, the fair market value of the Biggs lot? Did any of you know its value when you voted to sell the county-owned land to the out-of-state investment corporation domicile in Ohio? This is what we have been able to establish. First, a Tompkins County assessment in 2009 valued the land at $340,000. This was not an appraisal for the purpose of selling the property to develop a 60-unit housing complex. This appraisal assessed the land in as-is condition strictly for the tax assessment purposes. Second, let's look at the email sent by Ed Marks explaining why it was not feasible to substitute Cornell's conifer land for the county's Biggs property. I quote, "Any sale must yield a fair market value for the school," and that means Cornell School, Hotel School. A few paragraphs later, he says, "Unlike some other Cornell properties, because of the connection to the hotel school, any sale of the Cornell property must achieve fair market value. The county, on the other hand, may have the option of balancing the public benefit with the financial return on the property." By the way, the existence of Cornell's RFP has never been disclosed to the West Hill residents, despite many questions about alternative sites. We know about it only because of the recent FOIA request. Third, on September 29, 2013, Will Burbank answered my question regarding the proposed price for the Biggs lot. $500,000, which was more than the appraised value. This is consistent with the PR campaign claiming the county was getting a great deal. Fourth, on November 5, 2013, Joan Jurkovic of the County Planning Department posted an frequently asked questions link regarding Biggs property project. One of the questions was, how much is the county being paid for the property? The answer was, the county is being paid $500,000. This figure is based on the County Assessment Department's estimate of a per unit value for land for this type of development.
Can you sum up for us, please?
Pardon?
Can you sum up for us, please? Your time's up.
Pat Dutt is giving me her time. Thank you.
Is that true? Thank you. Go ahead.
However, the county is making up to, that's a continuation of the quote. However, the county is making up to $160,000 from these proceeds available to off-site improvements to the transportation system, which may include pedestrian walkways and possibly a transit shelter. The $160,000 represents the difference between $500,000 and the appraised value in 2009 of $340,000 based on likely development for low-density suburban-style housing if offered on the general real estate market. Fifth, The recent response to my follow request disproved the above-mentioned pricing information. No estimate of 500,000 could be located. In fact, the only statement from the County Assessment Department denied any participation in pricing the land at 500,000. I quote, "This says 500,000 by the Assessment Department. My estimate was always 340,000. Let's review the facts. The above evidence suggests that the county offered 25 acres of valuable public land for sale without conducting any valuation. This is clearly a case of negligence that shows a gross lack of accountability to the public. The county representatives misled the public as to the pricing methodology and alternative sites. This lack of transparency was intentional and willful. The county knowingly discounted the value of the land for the benefit of the for-profit Ohio investment firm to assure they, not the public, will get a good return. This is corporate welfare at the expense of Tompkins County residents. The county legislature did nothing to examine the terms of the sale to ensure fair sale price. The requests from the West Hill residents to postpone the vote until proper valuation takes place were ignored. The county land has been practically given away, and we need to find out who is responsible for the price manipulation, who acted as the estimator, what the true market value of the Beeks land is, and how much public wealth was wasted. In conclusion, I would like to officially request that the pricing process be thoroughly investigated, the facts gathered and disclosed to the public at the public hearing. Please kindly put this investigation on your agenda. On behalf of all Tompkins County residents, I demand that the county obtains the services of at least two independent appraisers to appraise the value of the county-owned Biggs property, not for tax assessment purposes, in essence.
We're going to need to have you conclude, please.
Sure. But for the purpose of sale tied to the proposed improvements of 60 units. The West Hill residents would like to choose one of those independent appraisers. This has been long overdue. Please advocate to get the property appraised properly. More than that, please show the Tompkins County residents that you act in good faith. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Paula Ioannidou.
Hi, before I proceed, I'm looking at the agenda. Is the bonding of the jail expansion an item on tonight's agenda?
No, it's not.
Okay, then I will hold my comments for the time that it is. Well, I guess we were misinformed.
Gino Bush.
Well, I too thought that was on the agenda for tonight, but also I would like to extend an apology to you legislators for the language that I used here a couple of meetings back. I wasn't raised like that, so I'm apologizing to the legislators. Thank you. That's all I got to say. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Love you guys. You're doing a good job.
Barbara Coleman.
You already heard me say that I'm chair of the Human Rights Commission for Tompkins County, and you were provided with 11 applicants for the 11 openings. I want to tell you, I was in awe of the caliber of these individuals who have applied to be on the commission. We have a diversity of interests, of ages, of gender, and with my background, when I sit and I'm in awe, that's really something. We will have a commission, and Tompkins County will be aware that there is a commission, an active commission of people with a broad range of talents and interests and passion. And with Karen's leadership, It's going to be amazing. And so if you have any questions, I will be here. And I hope you find, when you look at the list, you see names. But when they came in and sat down before us and began to share their backgrounds, what they've done, what they continue to do, and what they want to do, it was so exciting. And so it's a privilege for me to be here and to be part of that group. Thank you.
Barbara, we'd like to say thank you to you and all those applicants and people who are on the list for coming forward. This is a really important group in our community, and it's great to have it revitalized again.
And what is so exciting, we have some young people who are, to me, they're young. They're in their 30s. And we have the age range going into the 70s. And the experience and the knowledge and the passion, I'm telling you, it is, I'm very excited. So,
thank you. I have Courtney Short. Okay.
Hi, I'm Pat Dodd, and I live on the West Hill, and I just have a very brief comment, and it's related to Sophie's comment about the Biggs property, but it's actually about the West Hill. We on the West Hill have never been against development, but historically we have been misrepresented as being against development. We're not against development. And the reason the legislatures have misrepresented us is because that's a way for them to close us out of the conversation. And we're not against development that's sustainable, but we're against development that promotes sprawl and that promotes itself as sustainable, but is actually degradatory to the environment. And that allows non-local big corporations to basically steal our land and develop that land without regard to existing neighborhoods. So I'd like to extend an invitation to everyone sitting here today. And we'd love to meet with you in a small group, we on the West Hill, and discuss honestly what development could look like on the West Hill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on privilege of the floor? Please state your name and municipality.
Hi, Joanne Cipolla-Dennis. I wanted to thank Will Burbank and the other members of the legislature who went up to the jail last week. Was it Dan and Dooley, am I understanding? Thank you for doing that. So tonight it's my intention to move your heart. So I'd like to ask your full attention, please. Confinement is a horror I refuse to talk about for many years. It was a Pandora's box for me, a visceral reaction, like tearing a dressing off a wound and adding salt. I hope you're at a time in your life when you're able to listen with your heart. I hope my experiences give you clear visual and deeper understanding into the unspeakable. When I was 30, I was hired by the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice as a corrections officer in a maximum security prison, now a privatized child prison system. We were subjected to frightening riots, bomb threats, and continually understaffed, many lacking proper training. There were no guns inside the walls, only handcuffs, shackles, radios, keys, and my partners for protection. I witnessed blatant, intentional torture of children daily, who were in 8x10 cement block cells with steel doors. Their only ability to see outside the claustrophobic gray cement coffin was a tiny 4-inch by 12-inch long glass window. Children were not allowed to look out those tiny windows. Children, teenagers, handprints on those tiny windows are imprinted in my memory. It reached 112 degrees inside the cells, but there aren't any fans in prison. I witnessed denial of asthma medication to treat the heat stroke and solitary confinement. I faced ridicule for letting my heart show when I gave them medication, which was discouraged. My partners would often target gay inmates just to be cruel to them and taunt them. And they would confine them to get them out of the way. I'll carry those memories forever. Unjust confinement is defined as torture in other nations for the unspeakable toll it takes on humans, including those who must witness that suffering. Some guards face threats, so they maintain their silence. I have to maintain that silence. What can't be silenced is the screaming, the crying, the begging from inside the concrete cell. I hear it some nights, even after 20 years in a very successful therapy. It's reoccurred since my study of the expansion in October. At 30, I did not understand the collateral damages confinement levies on those within the walls. It radiates throughout the community in death, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, aggression, drug abuse, alcoholism, isolation, and physical abuse to family and communities. Those are the real repercussions of that kind of job. I could not know at 30 that minds, hearts, bodies for inmates and officers would be so permanently affected by a system set up to use, abuse, replace, and fail us all. What is most regrettable are the damages to my own body as a result of an assault of a young woman of 15 years old who was mentally ill while in solitary confinement, who snapped in an uncontrollable blank rage as I unlocked the door to feed her. It challenges me daily. A more compassionate and responsible society would have ensured any ill child a hospital room rather than a prison cell, and she and I still suffer. Her confinement with no bed, no pillow, no blanket, only a bra and underwear would drive even the strongest adult to insanity. Imagine the torture to a mentally ill 15-year-old child. The attack for which she...
Can you sum up for us, please?
The attack for which she had little control over likely sent her to adult prison at 18 as a battery on an officer, a felony. I had no control over her charges. A prison-for-profit system cost her things that are unspeakable. It cost me my ability to work again, to have a normal life, to bear children as I wanted and planned. And I will never know the joy of grandchildren on my knee because I took that job. And I lived in poverty, abandoned by a very system that convinced me that it was my job, was so important, I could place myself at such high risk. If I was not married today, I would attempt to live on $12,000 a year without medical. The CO I replaced never worked again. She had brain damage from the beating before me. Someone replaced me. In a few days, I will face another risky surgery to replace the pain implant that saved my life but has failed twice in 8 years. The tragedies are endless in a broken system. It never ends until we end it by understanding that we cannot keep doing the same thing and finding justification for the unjust. Now at 52, I am wise.
Please?
I'm almost finished.
Thank you.
Now at 52, I'm wise to the true cost of having a job in the industry that tortures human beings, starting with our children. At 33, I almost chose death to end my relentless suffering, and just in time, I met my wife. Usually, unjustly confining human beings in order to expand and then saying it's humane is unconscionable to me. If you could only feel what I carry, hear what I hear, you would choose another solution. I still see them locked in cement coffins in tiny little windows with tiny little handprints. They screamed for their mama. They begged for forgiveness.
They pleaded with God and me to show them some mercy. I was too young and naive and unable to grasp that reality. You are not too young and naive. You must listen to me now. I am asking you for mercy for those in jail who do not need to be unjustly confined. Please know that your vote for this plan will cause their unjust confinement, and the karma will not admit you, and this vote will define you. I urge you to vote again on the one-year moratorium because it is too important and the damages are too undone, not to be undone. The human and community costs are too high. You cannot always talk about the money. It should always be about exhausting all reasonable avenues and seeking the best solution, not just a solution. Maybe I am your reminder that understanding should not be left to others in such matters that cause people unconscionable lifetime suffering. Once you know, you cannot not know. Now you know. You all know. Do not confine people unjustly just to pass a plan. Please do not do this. There are better ways. You know better ways. I am counting on you to make a better solution. That is your job. I expect you to do better. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak on privilege of the floor? Yes, please state your name and your municipality, and please remember the three-minute time limit.
Okay, and I live in Ithaca, in the city of Ithaca. And I emailed you guys today.
We didn't get your name, please.
Sherry Cortice, K-O-R-T-H-U-I-S.
Thank you.
And I emailed you all today about the SCOC and the boarding out issues. And I don't know if you guys read that at the New York State localgov.org website, how they use the variances so that we have to board out. And so, you know, but then I guess my other issue is, why are people in prison? I think I asked that last time. I'm with her on the moratorium. After sitting through the planning meeting from 3:30 to 5:30, the plans that I saw just don't cut. It looks like what I think it should be is rehabilitation, because most of the people, from what I understand, who I talk to in the community, are being arrested for drugs and alcohol and, you know, stealing. And, you know, there's no violent, you know, I have a friend that there's violent criminals. We know that there are people, but there are people that don't need to be locked up. And I guess that's where we're trying to get with this. The one-year moratorium is a great idea, especially with this bond issue. Also, after seeing the plans, I can't imagine that it would cost that much to build what they're trying to build, and would like to know when the meeting is that they're going to vote on the final bond resolution. We thought it was today, and now I found out. Is it April 15th indeed, so that we can come speak again against that? And there will be other opportunities before then for the public to see these plans, because I think the public needs to see these jail plans, because they're really not. I would have thought they'd have done a better job. But anyways, thank you for your time and your consideration, but I really think a moratorium would be much better and give everybody time to rethink this issue. So thanks for your time. Bye.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Okay, then let's move on to, are there any municipal officials? I didn't see any. Privilege of the floor for legislators. I have Brian.
Yeah, I just wanted to answer that question. And ma'am, or whoever else would like to know, there was a presentation on the scope of the project today. There will also be one next Monday at 4 o'clock at the Budget Committee meeting. Same thing. Same gentleman, Mark from Labella, will be here. There will also be on April 1st, presentation of the full legislature on that, and then the bond resolution vote by this body will be at the following meeting, which is April 14th. Okay.
I think it's the 15th.
Or 15th, I'm sorry, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else? Dan Klein.
Yeah, I want to put an issue on your radar if it's not there already. And this is the sad, sad story of rural bus service in upstate New York and New York State government and Medicaid. And so I'm going to talk about Tioga County because that's where much of the story takes place, but it affects some other counties too, which I'll highlight. So Tioga County has no hospitals. This is something I just learned a week ago. So when many people in Tioga County need to go to a medical appointment, they have to go out of county, and a lot of those people come to Ithaca. And particularly Medicaid patients, when they have a medical appointment that Medicaid takes care of, they come to Ithaca. And the way they get to Ithaca is by bus. New York State Department of Health funnels the Medicaid money and subsidizes medical transportation, and that's how Tioga County's entire bus system is funded. About 5 months ago, abruptly, New York State changed the way that it's funding its Medicaid transport. And at this point, instead of putting people on buses, they are putting people in taxis. So what's happening in Tioga County is basically ridership just disappeared. And it looks like their entire bus system, unless something has changed, their entire bus system is going to cease to exist. And one of the reasons that this matters to us in Tompkins County is that Tioga County runs three bus routes from Tioga County to Ithaca. And some of those routes have several buses a day. And some of those areas that they cover are not covered by TCAT. TCAT at this point does not run any buses outside of the county. So there are going to be a number of spots in Tompkins County that are either going to have a decrease in bus service or possibly no bus service at all. And one of those spots is West Danby, which is what put this on my radar. So this is affecting a lot of other upstate counties as well. Not necessarily their entire budget is from Medicaid, as Tioga's is, but a significant portion of it. So Cortland County, Schuyler County, they both run buses to Ithaca that might be eliminated because of this change in funding. Let me just find this piece of paper a second. Some information about the other counties. Thank you. Cortland County, this is just since October 1st, since the state made this change. They have lost 31% of their county transit revenues because of this change by the state. Ithaca services from Cortland to Ithaca is down by 13%, and they have laid off 7 of their 20 bus drivers already. Chemung County has had a 15% decline in transit system revenue. It's $900,000 to Chemung County. Schuyler County, I mentioned, may have to eliminate their route to Ithaca. Shenango County has had a 32% decline in their total transit system revenue since October. So there's no ending to this story yet. These counties are getting together and trying to change the way New York State funds their bus system. I wanted you to be aware of it. I will come back to you with more information next time as it develops. Thank you.
Anyone else like to speak? Peter Stein.
Would it be in order for me to ask a question to my colleague on the left?
Sure.
I'd heard this story before, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Is it true that to send a person on a bus is more expensive than to send them in a cab? How does it work that New York State is making that decision? I don't understand it, okay?
So every day I'm learning more as I get further into this. There's a couple of things. One is that, yes, New York State is claiming that it is cheaper because they don't have to invest in an entire bus system. They can send a lot of taxi rides for the cost of a bus system. And then there's another part of it, too, and I don't know to what extent this matters, but there is New York State transportation aid to municipal bus service systems. And that aid is based on ridership numbers. So as bus ridership numbers decline, New York State also won't be paying this extra aid that was already going to the bus systems. And just to make that a double whammy for the counties is that not only are the counties losing the Medicaid money, they're losing the FAIR money, and they're losing the state aid money. So it's a triple whammy.
I see. So I guess what you're telling me is that New York State has an obligation to transport Medicaid people to their doctor.
I believe so.
They can't decide not to do that. That's a federal mandate. But New York State is not required to have a bus. A county is not required to have a bus service. So in that sense, that's how it gets to be cheaper.
I believe that's true.
Okay, thank you. At least now I understand that they're not crazy, just evil.
Anyone else? Carol Chock.
Yeah, Dan, this operates on top of, I think these are huge problems, and they operate on top of the difficulty we already experience in much more populated areas of the county achieving coverage. I mean, people live along Route 79 East. You cannot take a bus to work or to downtown other than at certain limited hours of the day and back at other limited hours of the day. That's the wrong direction at the wrong time. There's no way that we can pick up. We already have slack, we already have need that we're not picking up, and we're not going to be able to do that. It's just, I don't know, it really is overwhelming to think about how we're going to face what we need to face. And in light of that, I put something in people's red folders about something that happened at F&I, but I was going to talk about it now because it's not just an F&I matter. I think it spans. It has to do with bridge planning, long-range bridge planning, and it's that relationship to a highway department that exists to keep our current infrastructure in as good shape as it can, and that's its charge. The fact that we no longer have a commissioner, we used to have a joint commissioner of planning and public works, and we have some new realities in terms of state funding. And I was going to talk a little bit about that because it spans not just F&I, maybe planning and the other things that we do and the budget problems we talk about. But I see we don't have any of the staff here who this would be relevant to, and there are staff here and people from the public on other matters. So if I could have permission to talk about that, maybe under F&I, it's a matter that the committee chose not to bring to the legislature related to the specific bridges that we were talking about. But I didn't necessarily want to do it then. I was going to do it now, but I will wait if I can have time later to do it.
We'll try to squeeze you in there.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Martha Robertson, then Mike Sigler. I'm going to put myself on.
Yeah, I think the issue of the bus service is it's really complicated because... As was said, there might be a bus in the morning in from Tioga and a bus out in the afternoon. So it's not like that's really high-quality bus service for somebody in Tioga County who has an 11 o'clock appointment. They have to come in at 8 o'clock and can't go home till 5 or 6. So you can see it from that point of view that a taxi cab is more user-friendly for the client. Maybe it's a function of that New York State actually was relatively creative in previously using Medicaid transportation funding to do double duty and support rural bus service. Now, if this is a new way of looking at serving those Medicaid clients, they really better take a hard look at how they serve the public for basic transportation, because I think it's something that's only going to get more and more important for people in rural areas, and we have many people coming to Tompkins County for jobs from outside the county, and it would really be nice if people have an alternative way to get here instead of a car. So So it may not, you know, it's not like necessarily evil. I think it's complicated. I think it's there are a lot of different ways of looking at these things. But the bottom line is that we really need to address the core issue of how do we support public transportation.
Mike Sigler.
I just had an announcement and a question. Tax assessment review hearings are coming up. Lansing is scheduled for May 19th at the town hall from 3 to 6. So if you have any questions, you can go visit the Lansing website. I'm sure it'll be on there. So, again, that's May 19th, 3 to 6. If you have any complaints about your assessment, please come and tell us. Carol, this bridge, this isn't the Stone Bridge, is it?
Why don't we talk about it under F&I? Shall we talk about it under F&I?
Okay. Yeah, that was the only question
yeah.
I had. So.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to mention that today is an election day in our six villages. And although there's only one village that currently has a contested race, which happens to be my village, the village of Dryden, I would encourage people in all the villages to go out and vote. There are people standing for election. You can make your choice for them or not, or they could write in somebody else. But it's still important to go out there. These folks are standing for election, and they ask for the voters to affirm them or vote for someone else. And I think it's really important that we do all we can to try to get the voter participation in Tompkins County up as high as we can. So I hope folks out there listening in TV land will remember to go down to the polls and vote. They're open till 9 p.m. Ryan.
I'd love to. If you can promise we can get out of here by 9.
We're supposed to vote before you came.
I think it opened at noon, and I wasn't there at noon.
True. Anyone else want to speak on privilege of the floor? We have some important things to follow up on here, so can we move ahead? Thank you. We're pleased to have the president of Tompkins Cortland Community College here, Carl Haynes, who's here to talk to us about the college and what he's going to be seeing for the next coming year. Carl, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for making time on, I know, a very busy agenda for our county legislature this evening. I have two broad areas that I want to address in terms of my State of the College report, which I provide to you on an annual basis. First, I want to give you a few highlights in the brochure, and everybody should have one at their seat. And following that, I want to address some what I am framing as continuing challenges at the college that we're facing, and give you an overview of how we're addressing those challenges. So first, a few highlights from the report. If you turn into the second page, you'll see a broad headline there that's called Instruction and Curriculum. A few highlights from that page that I would bring to your attention. First of all, we have last year approved two new degree programs, one in culinary arts and the other in sustainable farming and food systems, more popularly known as our Farm to Bistro initiative, which I know you're very familiar with. I'd also draw your attention to our expanded peer mentoring program that saw increased numbers of mentors and mentees achieve academic success, which is overall helping to strengthen our retention of higher-risk students. Third, I draw your attention to the expansion of our Open Educational Resources Initiative that provides online text material for students that saves them literally hundreds of dollars by avoiding textbook purchases. And also the customized training for 28 businesses, 1,370 participants through our Center for Adult Learning and Training last year. And I'd also note two of our faculty who earned awards for their scholarship, Gene Cameron and Lisa Ford, and their details of their awards are, excuse me, mentioned in the report. The next section really gets into the student engagement section, the next page. Four highlights here. First of all, three of our students last year were honored with selection of their photographs for display in the 2013 Best of SUNY Student Art Exhibit in New York State Museum in Albany. We're very proud of those students. Also, I would note that increased number of students participating in study abroad programs in Nicaragua, Ireland, Colombia, Italy, and Spain. And we also provided several events, programs, seminars to encourage understanding and awareness of diversity dimensions. And our athletic teams experienced success both on and off the court, on the court and in the field and in the classroom, I should say. Six of our nine teams made postseason play, three conference championships, and our athletes achieved a higher GPA than the average GPA of the rest of our student body. So that's something we're very proud of as well. In the community connections section, again, I'd highlight three items here. We hosted numerous local, state, and statewide high school events on campus, as well as several regional community college and national competitions. Our concurrent enrollment programs with area and regional high schools experienced a 17% growth over the previous year. And our student activities department was actively engaged in several community projects, including hosting four blood drives, a food drive for local food pantry. We raised $10,000 for cancer service programs in Tompkins and Cortland counties, $500 for Hurricane Sandy relief last year, and, of course, much more. And we also continue our partnerships with Cuca College, Delhi, Empire State, by offering baccalaureate programs for people in our community. And in the next section, page over, in the Central Resources, Culture, Human Resource Development, I would just make a couple of highlights here. We did exceed our annual campaign with our foundation, raising $218,000 last year, not counting, of course, the very special a gift that we got from Arthur Kukas of $3 million to support his pathway program. Our master plan projects continue on schedule. We're collaborating with other community colleges and hosting a program entitled Connecting, Collaborating, and Celebrating the Art of Teaching. And we continue to reduce energy costs at the college. And for the sixth consecutive year, we won the recognition for the Digital Community College Survey. And, of course, on the last page, I draw your attention to a number of our faculty and staff who were recognized with Chancellor and Trustee Awards last year. So that's kind of a highlight of the report, and if you reflect more on that, if you have questions, why, of course, I'd be happy to address them. Next, I want to address continuing challenges and how we're responding to those challenges. The following will highlight major trends of the past 5 years and the impact that those trends have had on both our revenues and expenditures. The key point here is what I'll present is that while these trends and challenges have been formidable, TC3 has responded strategically, in many ways sustaining excellence in our programs, and in several areas actually have improved our services. Budget revenues have been declining throughout the past 5 years. In 2009 through 2011, we had a 21% reduction in state aid. Sponsor aid remained stable. Our only source of additional revenue was tuition increases. And during that period of time, we were continuing to grow our enrollment, so that helped somewhat. Last year and this year, state aid increased by $150 per FTE each year, but state support is still $253 per FTE less than it was in 2008-09. So we're still way behind the eight ball in our state support. Enrollment last year and this year declined each year, part of a statewide and national trend. In the fall, this past fall, nationally, community college enrollment was down 4%, previous year 3%, previous year to that 2%. So you can begin to see the pattern that's developing here. Our fall-spring enrollment decline has been partially offset by our growth in our concurrent enrollment and global programs. Current projection for this year is that our enrollment will come in about 3,765 FTEs, which is 5.9% down from the 4,000 FTEs that we had in 11-12. However, when you compare our fall-spring enrollment for that same time frame, it's declined over 13%. And from a 15-year period that ended in 11-12, we had literally doubled our enrollment from 2,000 to 4,000 FTEs. So that 15-year trend of continuous growth sometime in the 10 to 14% annually range clearly has come to an end, at least for the time being. In summary, this five-year period has seen unprecedented cuts in state aid for community colleges in the early portion of this time frame, followed immediately by unusual trending decline both nationally and statewide in enrollment, a trend that seems to be continuing. So how are we responding? Well, the usual budget expenditure adjustments. Over 5 years, employment at the college has declined from 324 employees in 9-10, and this figure includes, by the way, our FSA employees, which has remained relatively steady, to approximately 280 projected for next year. That's a 14% reduction in our employment. Full-time faculty has declined from 77 to projected next year 63. That's an 18% decline. Now, a footnote to that number is that we have had an unusually large number of people opt for early retirement next year. That's reflected in that number. And we do hope that after beginning in 15-16, we begin to replace some of those faculty hires. Administrative and support staff have declined 18 and 15% respectively. Equipment purchases have declined 50% since 9-10. Department budgets drastically reduced except to accommodate contractual increases. Numerous restructuring and realigning of staff responsibilities each year as we experience these gradual reductions. And we continue to experience seemingly annual additional unfunded mandates and compliance reporting requirements that consume staff time and make reductions in several offices very difficult. Additional responses, and here I want to emphasize it's not all about budget cuts. Unlike what we hear from other community colleges, we have not taken an across-the-board approach to budget cutting. With hiring freezes, ban on staff travel, fixed percentage cuts to department budgets, and significant increases in class size, sometimes up to 70 or 100 students. We've been very strategic and deliberate where changes have occurred both in terms of staff and operational resources. For example, we have sustained our maximum class size at 30 students with a strongly held belief that doing so is consistent with our mission as a community college to support a close and collaborative interaction between our faculty and students that we believe contributes to helping students succeed academically and eventually graduate. During this time period, we've increased staff in our Student Success Office to support several initiatives on campus to improve student retention. We're in the process of hiring a director of philanthropy with resources that were freed up by an intentional realignment to support a foundation and college initiative to attract funding for those academic and academic support services they have a high probability of strengthening recruitment of new students and retaining and our retention efforts. We continue to develop new curricula that will attract additional students in innovative programs that will meet our local workforce needs and in other ways contribute to our local economy. Again, I'll mention the Farm to Bistro initiative. Additionally, a couple years ago, our wine marketing degree program began, and last year we hired a full-time faculty member to lead this program, the only full-time faculty member in this curriculum in the state, to support this regionally important industry. And with some outside financial support, we added a position to our Office of Multicultural Services to support a mentoring program that has proven its value in helping student retention efforts during the pilot phase of this project. Overall, this has been one of the most challenging five-year periods in the college's history. But I hope you feel that our responses to these circumstances have been thoughtful, strategic, and consistent with what you as our sponsors expect of us. I've highlighted the challenges of this five-year period, and unfortunately, it doesn't appear that any significant relief is in sight. While we have strategically managed these challenges, to this point, with noteworthy improvements, prospectively, this will be extremely difficult to do. Our budget revenues in one way or another are 80-plus percent dependent on student enrollment. There are significant and uncontrollable headwinds working against us these days in terms of trying to stabilize or even grow enrollment. However, what we can influence in terms of our recruitment and retention initiatives, some that I've outlined here tonight, are central to our strategic approaches to address declining revenues while we continue to restructure, realign, and reshape our community college. A community college that I believe will serve our students with excellence in academic and support services, our area employers with a well-prepared workforce, and our transfer colleges and universities with exceptionally well-prepared students for more advanced study. And in achieving all this, TC3 will continue to be a vital resource for the overall well-being of our community. So with that, I thank you for your attention, and of course, I'd always be happy to take questions or anything you'd like to ask me more about.
Thank you, Carl. Questions, Peter, and then Mike Sigler.
Carl, you were saying that this decline in number of students is happening in the community colleges all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
What do the wise people say is going on? Why is it doing that? And do you have you done any questioning of your students or the ones that decided not to come or something like that to see what it is that's bothering them?
Yes, so to the first question, okay, we've been doing a lot of work on that. I shared with our Board of Trustees about 2 months ago, 3 months ago, okay, a list of about 8 or 10 reasons why I think enrollment is declining, and again, not only just at TC3, but across the board. Let me just highlight a couple of those, okay? First of all, in New York State in particular, the number of high school graduates themselves is declining slowly. It's not dropping off a cliff like it did back in the early 80s or late 70s, but it is gradually declining for the next 7 or 8 years before it begins to stabilize and maybe move back up again. There's additional restrictions on how financial aid programs like Pell and so on can be used, and that's had an impact. There's increasing numbers of students that we know whose parents are being turned down for parent loans. This past fall, we had a 35% decline in parent loans, okay, for people that were either turned down and or chose not to engage in taking on debt to support their child's education at the college. That in the context of the most cost-effective kind of access that we are, okay, is a community college, okay, but it was still, I think, reflects a demographic that we tend to serve. The weak economy, I think, has been clearly a factor for both parents and students unwilling to take on debt. We know from many anecdotally, we know that many students have chosen to stay home instead of go away, so they can live at home. When that happens on a kind of a statewide basis, it's happening here too. But obviously, a few more students from Tompkins and Cortland County isn't going to offset. You know, what we're experiencing loss from out-of-county students. And I got to say also, related to this is what you're seeing in the media today. You know, almost weekly, if not seemingly daily, because I see a lot of this stuff in the higher ed journals, there's articles of questioning the value of a higher education and questioning the whether or not it's worth going into debt to get a higher education. Obviously, I would cite all the arguments why I think that's a good investment to be made, but there are those who are concerned about, I think, the economy, their job situation, their family finances, et cetera, that are just unwilling to take on that kind of risk and question the value of doing so. And I think the media debate on all that is not helpful. Now, admittedly, when you see this in the media, it's not talking about community colleges. They're talking about, you know, the six-figure level debt that you get at an Ivy League college. But on the other hand, the point washes over, I think, a lot of people that we would serve. I don't want to go on. There's probably 3 or 4 other things here I could mention. But, you know, it's not one thing. It's this collection of phenomena. Okay, that are all kind of coming together, I think, across the country. And I get the question all the time, you know, boy, the community college must be booming now because of the cost of higher education, and we should be the beneficiaries of that trend. Unfortunately, a lot of people that may in other times be taking advantage of that are choosing not to go to college and or go into debt to do so.
Thank you. That's interesting. I just want to make one comment. I really applaud that Farm to Bistro thing, and I'm rather amused by the fact that when I first came here to Ithaca, which was 60-some-odd years ago, Cornell was doing that same thing. they had a restaurant inside Cornell because they were teaching culinary arts to their students. That was part of their students. And so there was at the Statler, there was a restaurant that trained students and fed people. And it was really good food. And I was very sad when it fell apart. Now I'm looking forward to recreating that.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it as well. You know, it's a tremendous amount of student interest in that program.
Michael Sigler.
I'm surprised at that, too. I would think you would be the beneficiary. That wasn't my question, but I think that's kind of counterintuitive. I mean, it's so much cheaper than college.
The alternative.
Right. I'm surprised at that. I love these little survey numbers that you surveyed your graduates with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any kind of idea of how many people who go to TC3 then remain in the state afterwards? I don't know how you would know that, but you might, because you have all these other numbers. Because I'm willing to bet.
I don't know about the state, but I do know that approximately, now the number I'm going to give you is maybe a couple of years old, okay, so I haven't looked at it recently, but roughly around 70% of our alums live within Tompkins, Cortland, or contiguous counties. Okay, and work, okay, in this region, okay. So a pretty significant portion, I think, do stay here. Now, not obviously the other 30% don't. Now, I'm not even sure, you know, if you get to other parts of the state or New York City or something, a portion of that other 30% might be in the state. But there are some that will leave the state and go other places. But a significant portion, 70% was the last figure I saw that as alums, okay, those are people who graduate from TC3, have a degree, and will stay in the contiguous county, the central New York region.
No, I asked just because it's nice to know that you're educated, like, the people who live here.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
Mike,
matter of fact, I ran into one of our grads just
a little while ago.
I don't know. There
we go. Right.
Carol Chock.
Yeah, I had a question about that. Well, two questions. One is about, you mentioned the decrease in the number of faculty, staff faculty. I'm wondering about the change in number, whether it was an increase or decrease in adjuncts or people who teach in other ways, not part-time staff. But
the adjunct faculty, yeah.
Yeah. And then my other question is about the survey. You've got 67%. Being employed in jobs related to their field of study, and 56% transferring to another college or university, and that adds up to more than 100%.
Well, some do both.
I'm trying to look at what percent end up, you know, not having something to do afterwards.
I'm not sure the answer to that. I could probably figure it out. But a little hard to do that right on the fly right now. But there is some overlap because of, you know, some students will get a job and then continue on, part-time at college, or be working part-time and go to college full-time or something. So, but anyway, back to your first question,
adjuncts.
Which managed to go right out of my head.
Adjuncts.
Oh, the faculty hiring and stuff like that. We had, we got surprised, actually, by the number of people who opted for an early retirement incentive. Which they had to do by February 14th. We had 13 people from our faculty association, 11 of whom were teaching faculty, opt to retire. They have to retire at least by 2016. But seven of them are retiring that will impact the next budget year. And so it's too late for us to be recruiting, and nor can we afford to do it right now, frankly, for next year. But we hope in 15-16, the following year, to begin to replace maybe at least three of those positions. There's another half a dozen retirements coming in the subsequent 2 years, and to gradually, over 4 years or 5 years, begin to replace some of those faculty. So we will be replacing, I hope, most of those faculty. Of course, as you well know, okay, you can replace an entry-level faculty member at a lot less money than you can someone who's retired after 35 or more years. So we are relying on adjunct staffing, but at the same time, keep in mind that we've probably this year and again next year, each year, probably reduced the number of section offerings and things of that sort probably by 50 or 60 each year because of the declining enrollment. So there's less demand on that for the number of people that we might otherwise be hiring.
Have you increased the number of adjuncts?
Well, yes.
Some of the courses?
Well, for next year, for sure. The next year will be a transition year where we will be, but not proportionally to what the faculty reduction is. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make, because the number of courses and sections will be reduced.
Carl, there seems to be an assault at the state level by some counties to the chargeback system. I wondered if you might want to briefly explain some of the problems that would happen if some of those proposals went through.
I'd be happy to try to do that, Mike. It's a very complex...
I understand, but I just thought folks ought to be aware that it's...
Yeah. Well, it's great to be aware of that, because it sooner or later, I think, could impact, I think, your county, okay, in terms of... What it means, both in terms of what you pay as a chargeback to other counties where a student leaves Tompkins or Cortland and goes to some of the other community colleges, or in terms of what you receive through our budget process when students come here. So it's kind of a two-way street in a way. Tompkins Cortland Community College has been the recipient of, I think, something in the neighborhood of over $4 million in our budget, okay, as a result of chargeback revenue. So it's a big deal for us. There's some counties, and I think my own opinion is that the louder voice is coming from non-sponsoring counties in the state that don't sponsor a community college, that are, they have, for various reasons, which it gets a little difficult to say in a soundbite, but for various reasons are wanting to see the chargeback rate either just go away so they don't have to pay it anymore, or be drastically reduced in some fashion, but they want it recalculated, a new formula of some sort. The proposal that was tentatively agreed to, and I put that in kind of quotes because a lot of our presidents didn't agree to it, but it would have cost TC3 over $200,000 next year in chargeback revenue. And on the other hand, our friends right up the road here at Cuga would have cost them over $2 million. So there was a very uneven kind of option that was presented. It had a negative impact. Cumulatively, it was over $17 million in terms of the community colleges. And I know the state Senate right now has a proposal to defer any change in the chargeback formula and to continue studying it for another year. And I was on the phone not more than an hour and a half ago with Senator Seward advocating strongly that he support that, which he is supporting, and I hope the Assembly will support that as well. So it's I hope that the status quo in terms of how the formula develops, the chargeback rate will stay in place for another year, and there does partly need to be some change. I don't think we're opposed to that, but in how to make that change happen is, I think, something most of us agree with. How we get to that, how we implement that change, is what gets to be very difficult, because there's some really unintended consequences in that process where there's some real winners and some real losers, and that's it, trying to thread that needle is going to be the real challenge, and we need more time to figure that out.
Thank you. If it comes to a point where you think comment on this would be helpful, committee, and possibly pass a resolution or whatever you feel is would be helpful there.
Well, sure will, and I shared some information, or I think we did. I hope we did. I'll check on that with Joe, and I know he'll be following up with Steve Aquario to make sponsoring counties' views heard. I'm editorializing here, but my sense is that for some reason your county association was hearing more from non-sponsoring counties than they were sponsoring counties. And, of course, the sponsoring counties, a lot more of you, and you're the ones that were going to bear the hurt, okay, when your community colleges were losing revenue. So there has to be a balance in how I think your county association addresses this. And I could be wrong, and I'll stand to correct it if I am, but I'm very concerned that there was a one-sidedness to how it was being approached.
Thank you. I think that's important because it's real dollars and cents. Dooley?
This is the most discouraging report I've heard from you in all of my years listening to you. And I'm so sorry that you're feeling the pressure that you are. The one thing that is encouraging to me that you have done and can do more of is probably solar panels. I saw in your report that you have added photovoltaics to the student center, and that's a good investment.
I couldn't quite get that.
Solar panels.
Solar panels.
Oh, yes. Actually, that's happening this coming year, so I'll tell you more about that next year.
That's the right direction.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry I came off a bit negative. I was trying to be straight, but at the same time, I think we are doing our restructuring and reshaping in a way that I think continues to deliver high-quality services for our students and our community, and I hope that the concluding message got heard as well. But along the journey the last 5 years, it hasn't been easy, that's for sure.
Anything else? Carl, thank you for coming out tonight. We appreciate your report, and we know in the past you've always done your best for us, and we're sure you will.
Well, very good, and thank you all for your patience and listening tonight. Thank you.
Next, we have our Deputy County Administrator, Paula Younger, who's going to talk to us about county compliance. And one of the things that we have to do is take some training, and this is going to help us take care of that. Welcome, Paula.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much. I'll try to make this brief and move it along a bit. And, of course, if there are questions along the way, please don't hesitate to ask. But I think that I've provided you with some ample documentation so that you can read some of this on your own. There are two documents to support this presentation. One is the actual handout of the PowerPoint. And then, of course, you have the detailed compliance report, which you can read at your leisure or share with a friend. Also, there is a third item there, which is an attestation form, which I will address at the end of the presentation. But if you want to get ahead of things, feel free to print your name on the top line and sign the second one, and all will be explained at the end. I want to just give you a brief overview of our compliance program. Obviously, we have a vision and a mission statement for what we do. We want to ensure consistency in how our staff address compliance issues, so we're working to achieve a culture of consistent compliance in both regulatory and ethical areas. We do this by administering a proactive countywide agenda where we try to integrate best practice along with compliance requirements in a way that help all of our operations improve their monitoring systems, look at controls, identify areas of risk and help to mitigate them, and, of course, demonstrate transparency. We also have some guiding principles, which these probably wouldn't come to surprise to anyone because this is what we use across all of our operations at the county, but they're ethics, quality assurance, excellence, and, of course, staffing and team confidence. We work with integrity. We hold ourselves accountable for what we do. We invest in learning and improving performance. And we also recognize that employees are our greatest resource. And so by keeping them up to date, training and so forth, it allows them to contribute better to ensure that the program is solid and collaborate as well. Our stakeholders in the program include the county administrator. He decides who sits on the compliance committee, and we report all of our recommendations to him as well as our progress. Of course, all of you as the governing board members are key stakeholders, our departments, in particular department leadership. Of course, all of the regulatory authorities that put forth the requirements that we have to follow. And then, of course, the community we serve, because it is through our program that we demonstrate good stewardship of their trust and resources. Our compliance program consists of eight elements, and these eight elements actually were prescribed by the Federal Office of the Inspector General. This is the sort of standard framework I think that you would find in most compliance programs, whether you're talking private industry, even higher education. Matter of fact, I think I heard President Haynes mention a little soundbite about staff time in having to adhere to regulatory requirements. So you're going to find this is the standard framework. It consists of our compliance committee, and I also serve as your compliance officer. We have various written policies and procedures, disciplinary procedures. Of course, there's staff training. We are trying to beef up in areas of identifying risk and putting corrective action steps in place. We also have whistleblower protections and a formal policy for that. And then we also have processes for confidential reporting. Our compliance committee consists of these fine people listed here, and a few of them are here this evening. Of course, our county attorney serves on the committee, so does our finance director, Frank Krupa, who is our health department director, is joining us this evening. And, of course, Commissioner of Personnel, Social Services, Mental Health, and our Information Technology Services Director. In addition, we established this past year a privacy and security work group. I will talk a little bit more about that, but because of new requirements that have come about with HIPAA and high tech, we found it necessary to put a small work group in place to help us with those particular processes and policies. That work group includes Karen Ganta from the Mental Health Department, also Mary Hayes. Our Commissioner for Social Services serves on that work group as well. Lauren Cottrell, the deputy for ITS, also serves on there. And I believe Brenda Crosby also participates on that work group as well. Sue Romancic sits in on occasion, and I also work with the work group on occasion as well. Just want to share with you a couple of the milestones so you get a sense of how far we've come with our program. We established the program in 2011, and that was just to put the basic infrastructure in place, to put our committee in place, to establish what we call our compliance program plan, and also what we refer to as our anchor policies. I mentioned earlier the whistleblower policy, as well as the exclusion screening policy. Also, ironically, around that same time, you were working to improve or to update your ethics policy and standards of conduct, and they, too, serve as anchor policies as a part of this program. In 2012, we conducted an internal risk assessment of our departments, and we were asking them to look at issues like data security, how they actually inform staff of new policies and sort of help them in terms of implementation. We asked them questions around information breaches and things of that nature to see how they would handle those circumstances. That then gave us guidance on how to then begin to improve our plan in terms of assessing risk. We also established a more formal staff training program. When we started the program in 2011, it was really more of an introduction to what compliance is and an introduction to the program and why. Now we're a little more sophisticated in our content. We also worked on some documenting or putting some protocols in place for how we handle whistleblower complaints. So we had a policy in place, but we really needed a protocol to really tell us exactly what we would do step by step should we receive a complaint. And happily, we haven't had any. There have been a few that thought that our whistleblower hotline was the sheriff's hotline, but this is clearly for waste, fraud, and abuse within county operations. In 2013, we started to look more closely at ITS security policy planning, and that will certainly be a part of our focus for 2014, which I'll talk about in just a minute. We actually improved our web presence. We sort of capitalized on the fact that we got a whole new look on our website, and so we actually have a county web page that is dedicated to our compliance program. If I have a chance, I might show that to you at the presentation or where to find it. And then, of course, we started to do a lot of work on HIPAA High Tech. High Tech, by the way, is this lovely acronym that deals with health information technology and for Economic and Clinical Health Act. It is the omnibus rule that was set forth by the federal government. It looks at all of that individual private health information that we've been dealing with on paper for so long, but now that it's electronically managed, both how it is created, how it is maintained, how it is transmitted, We now have significant rules on how that information is to be handled, and, of course, significant penalties if it's not handled correctly. In terms of compliance program documentation, we do have a comprehensive program plan. We also established a couple of years ago a fact sheet series. We try to take important aspects of the program, put them into handy no more than two-page fact sheets, and these are the kinds of tools that are available to department heads and supervisors to share with staff when they want to do their own internal training. Of course, we do have all of the training materials documented, and all of that stuff is accessed on our webpage. There's the URL. We also include our administrative policy manual as part of our compliance program documentation. We also include the code of ethics and then the year-end reports, which leads to the document that you have in front of you. Hopefully it is informative reading. I know reading about compliance doesn't seem to be fun, but it does tell you exactly how staff time is being spent on this program. It also serves as the compliance committee's work plan so that you know what our priorities have been and you get a glimpse of what they are going to be in the coming year. Our compliance program report, we try to keep it organized fairly simply. So the first section is just a year at a glance. So if you just want to cheat to see what we've done, you can just read section one and go back and read the details later. We talk about key accomplishments. So for all of those priorities that we have set for ourselves, we then give you detailed information about how they were addressed. The issues and opportunities section are things that if there was something that we hadn't quite calculated correctly that we think is more of a challenge and will need more attention, we address that. If there was some serendipitous event that we still think is important to be documented, we also include that in the report. And then finally, like I said, we give you a glimpse of what to expect in the coming year. So these were our accomplishments for 2013. We put together an outline for about a series of eight ITS policies that will be coming down the pike. The one that we are working on now and close to finalizing is the acceptable use policy. That will come to GO, I'm hoping, by next month. But we also have policies with regard to safeguarding health information. That goes back to the HIPAA high-tech item that I mentioned a few minutes ago. We also are working on a breach notification policy. And then there are a number of, I'll just put under the umbrella, of data management policies. In connection with that, we also started to look more closely at staff training. And this is going to be a carryover in 2014 because of the variety of ITS policies and how they touch on almost every aspect of our operations. We want to ensure that staff are adequately informed and trained on how to implement the policies successfully. We also improved a little bit upon our exclusion screening process. I mentioned earlier that we have a policy for this. We realized that there were several staff out there, particularly those that deal directly with RFPs and bids and contracts and so forth, that they needed more hands-on training on doing exclusion screening steps prior to signing on the dotted line with a new contract or a vendor. We actually do our exclusion screening through a third-party vendor, which is Kenny Systems, and it's their K-Checks program. So Kenny Systems was able to provide web-based training for us, and then we talked amongst ourselves about how we might make some improvements internally. And then I've already touched upon the fact that we established our privacy and security work group as a result of the high-tech rule. So what to expect in 2014? We're going to continue the work that we started in 2013 with regard to IT policy planning and review. We will continue to recommend strategies for staff training. One of the things we also are discussing amongst department heads is a menu of what we considered required training for all staff employees. So that would be training in addition to what would be covered under compliance. So we're trying to work in concert with that particular plan to see how we might include compliance as well as the training on ITS policies. We also want to recommend a process for security risk analysis, and this is really dealing with data security. We know that folks are out there looking at different groupings of information, different databases, different systems. We need to get a better inventory on what they are, what they contain, who has access to what and when. And so that will be part of what we will do in 2014. I mentioned that we started our program in 2011, which means that our compliance program document now is 3 years old. So we're going to take a second look to see what needs to be updated and what needs to be included. And, of course, HIPAA High Tech is going to be one of those items. And then we'll also look to add to our fact sheet series, which is just a part of what we would do in continuing our training support to staff. So I said it would be quick. That's the end of the presentation. All of the detail, like I said, is in the report. I can certainly answer questions now, but you all know where to find me on the third floor at the penthouse of the old jail. That one last item, the attestation form, if you would please print on the first line, sign on the second, and then just pass those sheets all the way around to the county administrator's desk. And surprise, what this means is, you know how at the end of the year you get those friendly but annoying emails from me saying, will you please come to compliance training? Consider that requirement satisfied.
Thank you, Paula.
Thanks, Paula. Are there questions that we can ask Paula tonight? Arthur Robertson.
That is a beautiful signature.
Thank you.
I don't think it's a question, but anyway, thank you very much, Paul.
You're welcome.
Anything else? Paula, this is a very complicated issue. You do a great job trying to put it together for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and thanks to all of my colleagues that serve on the compliance committee, because we couldn't do it without their help and guidance, so thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. See, that wasn't painful, was it, folks?
Much better here.
Yes, it was.
For my report, just a couple of things. One, I was just reminded that we have to do our photo of the legislature that we do every 4 years. And Kathy Covert is wondering if sometime in May we'll work for that. So be thinking about that, possibly May 6th. We want to try to do it on a night when everybody will be here. So that's something we need to think about. I wanted to report to you that the county has been approached by two groups who are interested in establishing casinos in the region which Tompkins County falls in. One group, the Wilmot Group, is interested in having the state designate it the recipient of the license for a casino in the town of Tyre in Seneca County. The other is Tioga Downs, which currently has a casino down in Nichols, and would like to get the license to have it be designated as the casino. That's in, as I said, Tioga County. There are a couple of other ones out there which we have not been approached by. Basically, they're trying to gather support for their applications to the state. There are points awarded by the number of municipalities, apparently, that are supportive of various applications. Meetings were set up through Tompkins County Area Development. We met over in their offices. We were, I think, I would fairly say that we were noncommittal. They were both asking us for either a resolution of support or a letter of support. Some other counties already have done that for different casinos. They have their own cases about the amount of tax money that might flow to Tompkins County. Figures that in this chair's view are necessarily very speculative at this point. I explained to them that for the casino vote last year, Tompkins County voted 3-2 against the amendment at the state level, and that in the past, going back to 04, I think it was, we voted 2-1 against establishing off-track betting in Tompkins County. At this point, I am not planning to send it to a committee unless there are folks that would really like to have this issue brought forward to a committee as to whether we would want to support one group as opposed to another group. So if there are people who want to do that, I think you're going to need to weigh in on that in the next few days and let me know that. If that happened, then we would probably send it to a committee. Otherwise, I think we'll probably be sort of neutral in this matter. Peter Stein.
Just occurred to me, is it possible to be neutral by sending a letter of support to all applicants?
No. I don't think so. I don't think they'd get the points for that. It kind of would make us look a little odd.
Well, I mean, do they necessarily know after it's all over that we did do that?
Yeah, the Wilmot Group actually wondered if we would pass a resolution in support of its application, and the Tioga Downs Group asked if we could at least do a letter in support of its application.
Just a thought for the day.
Martha Robertson.
Well, the same group of people looks at all the applications, so they're going to see side by side, you know,
okay,
conflicting statements. You know.
It makes some sense.
Let's see. We've got Carol Chalk and then Mike. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Okay. Carol, then Mike.
I would just argue against that. I think that our residents voted against gambling for a reason. And so supporting all of them, I don't think, would do justice to the vote of the will of our voters.
Okay. I withdraw the thought.
Mike?
Withdraw the thought.
Just for my own information, I was actually under the impression those two weren't competing against each other.
Well, they very much are.
They are? We're all in that
it's
same.
It's a very strange-looking region with a long spike going up Seneca County way, mostly around Broome County. We're in it. But it's between the casino exclusive area for the Oneidas and the casino exclusive areas for the Senecas, I believe. And so we're in the squeeze area, and the state said even before the vote in last November that it would allocate at least one casino to this region. Anyone else?
Well, Mike, I thought the Ithaca Journal did a nice job of showing how foolish the calling an area the southern tier and having it extend so far north is. And that's what's confusing to residents.
Actually, we were told that in the state legislation it is not referred to as the southern tier region, but rather as, I just think, Region 6, they said. In fact, when the folks from Tioga Downs came yesterday, they never used the word southern tier in their presentation. Brian, is your hand up?
No.
Okay. For chair's appointments tonight, I'd like to appoint and add to the negotiating team Dan Klein to the negotiating team for the CSEA blue-collar unit and Peter Stein to the negotiating team for the white-collar unit. Let's turn to our county administrator, Joe.
Thanks, Mike. I have just a few updates tonight. First of all, in the old library, the RFEI was issued some time ago. The results or the responses came back Friday of last week. Without getting into the details of those responses, I'm happy to tell you that we received six very good responses. And that's I think, a strong indication of what's going on in the downtown economy and our economy generally. So we got really good responses. If you recall, the process is twofold. This is the first step of a two-step process. There'll be responses to the RFEI. Those are going to be reviewed by the Planning Advisory Board. The Planning Advisory Board will present its thoughts and recommendations to an ad hoc committee that has been named and formed. So that committee will be getting together at some time soon to look at the responses. They're not bound by what the PAB recommends, but that's certainly advisory to it. And I believe from there we'll go to the full legislature with respect to who should now receive an RFP, a more detailed response to the development of that site. So that process is now underway, but it's, again, the first step of this we should feel very good about because, again, six responses is great. I wanted to update you on the department head situation. We have two who you know have announced their retirement. I'll be putting together a search committee soon. I've extended invitations to folks to participate in those committees. I'm still getting their responses back, but we should have search committees together very soon to begin the process of looking for replacements for two folks who will be very hard to replace, Anita Fitzpatrick and personnel, and Bob Nicholas at the airport. So those processes will get underway soon. Since the search does take a long time, we want to get this going as quickly as we can. Brian will probably update you on the task force that has been pulled together to look at the jail alternatives. I'll pass it off to him. And I guess the last thing on my list is to update you on where things are with the state budget and specifically with the property tax freeze. We didn't get much good news over the past week or two. The governor's proposal, we're all very familiar with what the governor's proposal was. The assembly passed its one house bill first. In that one house bill, it's about as friendly as I guess we could hope for with respect to what they did with the tax, the governor's initiative. The assembly said we don't like that idea of a rebate. We don't like that the freeze. We do like the idea of a circuit breaker. Circuit breaker is an old idea, and it basically says if your property taxes exceed a certain share of your income, you get a state tax credit back to take some of the edge off of that. To the best of my knowledge, and I think it's accurate, there weren't any connections between that and staying within our tax cap or consolidating or those things. It was simply a way, I believe, to take some of the burden away from property taxpayers. That wasn't so bad. The Senate bill came out a few days ago. It took a 180 from the Assembly. It said we don't like a circuit breaker. We do like this freeze and rebate approach, but instead of rebating money to individual homeowners, we will give governments money. If they stay within the cap, we will give them money to bring their levy down to flat. So we would recognize that as a revenue, and if we went up 2%, call that $900,000. The state would give us $900,000, so that would flatten out the levy. That's their plan, and it is tied, again, obviously, to the cap, complying with the cap. And the consolidation requirements, which in the governor's plan are pretty ambitious. The governor says we have to save at least 3% of our levy over a three-year period. It's more good faith in the Senate bill. They say we want to recognize those who have done well in the past, so there's at least lip service to the kinds of things that we've done. And it's kind of a good faith in terms of the future. Challenge with the Senate bill, when you think about the business that we're in and when we need help the most, it's when times are worst. So you can imagine a situation where if the economy was really cooking, maybe we would have enough revenue gain where we could stay within the cap without cutting too many of our services. In that case, in the good times, the state would write us a check, we would flatten it out, and all would be good. But almost all of you here live through what we lived through after the collapse, and you know that when times get bad, our budget, we lose revenues, we gain expenses, that's when we need help the most, and those are the years where that money would be withdrawn if we couldn't stay within our cap. So it really doesn't work really to our advantage. So we're in a situation now where the now four men in a room, I guess, I was corrected the other day, four men in a room, they all have negotiating chits. And unfortunately, all of them are somehow into the property tax freeze thing. Nobody said no. So it's going to make it really difficult to come out of this with unscathed, I guess. We will continue to try to put as much pressure on the state as we can. I talked to Steve Aquario yesterday. We have thought about doing a press conference that would include local officials and maybe even school officials from throughout the county and maybe going beyond the county to weigh in and say it's not just a county issue, it's not a city issue. Every level of local government and every school district has grave concerns about the fatal flaws in this plan. I thought maybe Steve Aquario would say too little too late. He actually said, you know, it may help counterbalance what's happening right now in Albany. And as you know, the governor is going from county to county to pitch the tax freeze. And, you know, in terms of just rallying the troops, some of the language that we're seeing is pretty interesting, where he's describing the waste and duplication of local government that's driving up property taxes. And he calls for people to reduce the dysfunction and waste of local government, not to enable and subsidize it. So that's the kind of rhetoric that is heating things up right now. So based on a group that has come together through TCOG formed a group to say, what can we do to help lobby? And through the advice given by NYSAC, we are going to try to pull together a press conference, press event. We're thinking maybe Thursday afternoon. It's still a work in progress. It still could change. But we're thinking about a press conference Thursday afternoon that would include Mike to represent the county, a city rep, a town rep, a village rep, maybe a school rep, and again, maybe some people from other places as well, with a lot of other people there to show solidarity for the cause. So that's really the pushback that we're trying to help organize right now. But again, the way things are looking, it's very much uphill.
Could I just say that if we do have that press conference, you'd all be invited to come.
Absolutely.
Maybe not everybody speak, but we'd like to have the support.
Absolutely.
Martha Robertson had a hand, and then Peter.
Well, thanks for doing that and pulling it together, and it's great that TCOG is looking at that. Was it Tim Fagan, Tim O'Hearn and Fagan? Is that Schuyler County?
Tim O'Hearn is Schuyler, yeah.
They do something similar?
Very.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that there was a release of 100 local officials who signed a letter against the scheme, and the governor came out with 150 local officials who supported the scheme. And, you know, you can tell it's not really hard. You can figure out what he doubles down on. And you're right, that rhetoric is, you know, clearly he figures out who the villains are, and he, you know, puts a target on their backs. That would be us. So.
And he claims there's 10,000 municipalities. He's got 150. Peter.
Unless I'm missing something, the Senate proposal is essentially identical with the governor's proposal, except that it doesn't have all of that cost for writing those million checks, and probably doesn't make it easy for the governor to try to retaliate against people that won't go along. So given what's out on the table, I myself would support the Senate proposal.
Thank you. Anything else for Joe? Joe, are you anything else you wanted to speak about?
That's my list. Thank you.
Let's go to...
I'm sorry. Question.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
About the circuit breaker, renters, of course, pay the property tax through their rent. Circuit breaker doesn't help them, right? I mean,
no, it does.
In the governor's plan, there was some kind of a renter's assistance element of his plan. I assume that made it through the assembly.
All right. It's really good he's against bureaucracy.
That's right. So. And Peter and I will have a chat later about the Senate's bill, too.
Did I say the wrong thing?
There's no such thing as a wrong thing, but we'll chat.
Jonathan Wood, county attorney.
I have no report.
Rick Snyder, our director of finance.
I'd like to bring to you tonight the sales tax distribution summary for January. You should have a copy of it on your on your desk. We are only 1 month through the year so far to report on, and as you come down to the second section of the report, the top section, of course, lists all the sales tax, including the municipalities. I want you to turn your attention to the second section of the report, which is devoted just toward the county. You can see that for the month of January, we were down 10.55% compared to last January. Correspondingly, if you move over to the right a little bit further, you can see the year-to-date column is at $2,365,983. With only 1 month in the year-to-date is the same as the month of January, but that negative 10.55% is not as good as what we could have hoped for because we had such a resilient and robust end of the year with November and December receipts. But January was a very weak start for us. I should be able to bring you February's figures at our next meeting. They just came to my office on Friday. We haven't had time to receipt and to disperse them. But I wanted you to know that at this point in time, we should be at 8.3% of our budget for sales tax. And this shows that we are currently only at 7.2% of the budget for the month of January. Any questions on this? I'd be glad to respond.
Sounds like a disaster. Is that right?
Well,
or does this happen periodically?
We have weak months and we have great months. And I haven't been here long enough to be able to predict that January is always a poor month for you, but
being the old wise guy that I am, not a wise guy, but a wise person, the month-to-month can be very volatile. What you look for is at the end of the quarter, when the state reconciles a lot of things, you look at the end of the quarter. And if we're still trending bad at the end of the first quarter, we will be back to you to talk about plans to be able to keep our budget in balance. That would be a troubling thing if you saw it. Is it March, the end of March?
Yeah, at the end of March, we'll bring you the first quarterly report because there is that true-up that takes place at the end of the quarter, which kind of evens things out. But it's about $280,000 hit that we haven't met the mark. So we have 11 more months to go to weather this storm out. So I would not be too overly concerned with the first month. You all know the economic impact as probably due to many things, it being right after Christmas, the bad weather, et cetera. You can fill in the blanks for why sales tax would be down and not that much of a surprise. But we'll be bringing you February's at the next show. Same TV station, same...
Carol, then Martha?
Yeah, I was going to go the same direction as Joe, and then you just did with the weather. Would it make sense to start doing a 12-month comparison? So at the end of each month, you'd bring us, what was the comparison for the last 12 months with the 12 months of the preceding?
Well, that's what this attempts to show here. In the first two columns, I'm showing January to January.
No.
And then in the second two columns is on the right is year to date. And that shows all the months of the year added together. So you kind of get that picture year to date. It just doesn't make a lot of sense just being 1 month out of the gate at this point in time.
But that does compare an entire year
period.
Yes,
that will show the entire year period.
Okay.
Martha?
Thank you.
This is actually about pensions.
I'm sorry. Is this just the month of January or a 12-month period that we see in front of us?
It's just the month of January in the first two columns there. And then as a report is set up, then it's a year-to-date report that shows all the months for the year, but it doesn't show the last 12
months. It's only January for this year. So what I'm suggesting is that we look at an actual 12-month period that goes from February 1st to January 31st of the next year. So we get a real 12-month comparison. You know, this year, January, it was 0 degrees, and some of us thought that it might go above zero sometime before April, before we gave up on that and realized we got to go out and do our shopping anyway. So if we had a longer period to compare, it might give us a flatter look and a more realistic look rather than this big ups and downs month to month.
Yeah, because what Joe said is very true. We don't like to look at any one particular month because of the swings in the way that the state holds back money and retains money and then pays up at the end of the quarter. You know, sometimes those fluctuations do distort the true market reality.
Martha, then Jim.
Yeah, I was going to ask about pensions and the stock market. Is it March 31st when they take the snapshot?
Yep. Buy stock now. Drive that Dow Jones up. Yes, it is. They mark it at the end of March.
Okay, and so we're probably not going to look in good shape compared to a year ago, right? I mean, the stock market is up compared to a year ago, which would bode well for pensions in the next year. Okay.
Remember, it's a five-year average they use for the pensions.
Right, but it helps.
Jim's passing. Anything else for Rick? All right, thank you. I don't see any reports from county staff that we're planning tonight. Resolutions to be added and withdrawn from the agenda. Carol?
I just have a change. The LEED certification, the LEED resolution actually should be under government operations.
We'll take it there. Yep. Okay. Here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to do the consent agenda because we have folks waiting for those appointments. And then I'd like to move to GO for the local law, and then we'll take our break. Let's do the consent agenda. Appointments for advisory boards to the Human Rights Commission. We have Pat Pryor, Dave McNamara, Amy Scott, Talise Ladora Hampton, Mikkel Moss, Chantel Thomas, Leon Lawrence, Jamila Walita Simon, Kristen Brierley, Phoebe Brown, Isabel Ramos. To the Youth Services Board, we have Natalie R. Detert. To the Environmental Management Council, Linda Spielman. To the Library Board of Trustees, Cynthia Nicholson and Martha Walker. We have various resolutions. Resolution A, which is ID 4666, Budget Reappropriation for Unexpended 2013 Federal Funding to the 2004 Budget. I guess that's the only one. Is there Kathy, is that a motion?
Yes,
to accept the consent agenda? Is there a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Discussion? Those in favor of the consent agenda, raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Those opposed? That's unanimous. Nathan Shinagawa, would you please take up your resolution?
I would be honored to, yes. I have resolution B, adoption of local law A of 2014, a local law to enact section 470 of the New York State Real Property Tax Law, and I so move.
And seconded by Carol Chalk. Discussion. Peter Stein.
I'm hardly an expert on this. I know very little about it. But I was much impressed by the comment that got made by the gentleman whose name I've forgotten that came to the podium. And I just wondered how urgent this is, because my inclination would be to send it back to committee and ask them to think through those comments that were made. So I, before moving it, well, maybe I just better move it and see. So I want to move that.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask Irene to come up
so
she can respond to some things. So we have a motion to return to committee, Peter?
Correct.
Is there a second? Second?
Not second. I was going to speak against.
Okay. There's no second at this point.
I'll second it.
Seconded by Kathy Luz Herrera. Discussion on the motion to return to committee.
Okay.
We're going to let Irene respond to the question of how would delaying this affect your operations?
One of the conversations I had with Jay last week was that particular thing, and he said there's no rush on this. So if it's something that you need to get more information about, go ahead. We're not advocating for the exemption. We're just bringing it forward. We'll look at a property when the construction begins. So there's no rush on this.
Carol Chalk.
Was there intent when you brought the law forward to, I believe I'm remembering conversation to this effect, that you do want to see LEED certification as opposed to just general standards, somebody be able to come and say.
Correct.
Okay. So I actually took, the gentleman's name was Lewis Durland, and I took his comments and the law, and I went through and roughed them in, and it really is two very small changes that I could read off to you, and we could see, make one stab at seeing if we could do this tonight before sending it back to committee if you'd like. The third point that he made, which would need to go back to committee, my understanding is that this has to meet the state enabling law. The third point he made had to do with neighborhoods. And I've read the law, and I didn't see anything in there enabling us to allow this blanket exemption for neighborhoods. So that would need to go back to committee to look at. I don't think we can do it.
Yeah.
Right. So the other two would just be under Section 1, legislative intent. He was recommending, if you have packet page.
Well Carol, I think we got to stay to the point of whether we return this to committee. I think
you're starting to do committee work.
I would think that if this were voted down to return to committee, then what you're talking about might be moved as an amendment.
Yeah, but it also, I mean, you just have to eliminate the word standards. I mean, that's.
Yeah,
I don't think this has to go back to committee. We could take care of it right now.
That's my point. Is I was going to read off.
I just want to get it over with.
Yeah, I was going to read off what the changes would be that he was recommending, and to take one stab at whether we could, before we voted on whether to send it back to
Carol,
committee or not.
Can you say what they are real quick?
Yes. So they would be eliminating that word standards under Section 1, the very final word. We could just cross out that word.
Yeah, and the other one?
And the other one under Section 2, we would eliminate the words according to the appropriate. So it now reads an exemption shall be granted from county tax purposes based upon the scale below. And instead of the words according to the appropriate LEED, we'd replace the word standards with certification, LEED certification, and we'd replace those words according to the appropriate, those four words, with below for projects that achieve LEED certification.
Yes.
That's what he says in this letter, plus the neighborhood.
I think we're going to have to consult with our county attorney as to whether changes of that caliber would be such that we would have to have another public hearing on it or not. Can I ask that before going to the – we have several people that want to speak.
Yeah, sure.
The standard is whether the changes are substantial, and in my view, they, as a practical matter, really aren't, given Jay's explanation of how it would come into effect anyway. I don't think. I think that would be more of a clarification than anything.
Right.
So in my view, they're not substantial,
okay.
And we would not need to have another public hearing.
Thank you, John. I have Kathy Luz Herrera, Nathan Shinagawa, Dooley Kiefer.
Thank you. I want to start out by apologizing. I wasn't here for the public floor, and I apologize that I had a family health emergency. Anyway, I have some concerns about this, but they may have already been addressed. I appreciate Peter asking for it to go forward, because right now in Fall Creek, we're having a tremendous amount of discussion with regard to density, and I think it's a good discussion, but it's clear to me that there haven't been enough opportunities to really talk about some of the goals. And in this, even though it doesn't seem related, I think the LEED certification issue is one that hasn't been discussed enough in the community. I've gotten a few emails about it. The question that I have, and I apologize again, this may have been answered. The third whereas talks about once the property in question is initially LEED certified, any future changes in its LEED certification status will not affect this exemption. Okay, I'm picturing somebody puts in a solar hot water heater on the roof, and time passes, they get their LEED certification, and then it becomes clear to them for whatever reason that they're not going to keep it. So it's disconnected, and it's no longer part of it. And that was, let's just say for the purposes of this discussion, just what tipped it over the edge for getting the LEED certification. But according to this whereas, and I know y'all have discussed this, so you're going to help me, and then I have one more, then this property would continue getting the exemption even if they had slipped below LEED certification status. Yes?
No, if I may clarify, Kathy. So the, and Irene, please verify that what I'm saying is correct. It's if it was an existing property and they had an addition that qualified under this LEED certification, it's only the addition that actually gets that LEED exemption.
Correct.
So if they were to remove that addition, then that exemption wouldn't exist because the addition wouldn't be there anymore. In other words, these exemptions don't apply to the whole property. It applies to the addition that you make to the property.
But I'm talking about a project that qualifies for LEED exemption, and for whatever reason, some of the elements are taken away such that it would no longer achieve the requisite number of LEED points.
Right.
I'm not talking about a renovation or an expansion.
Correct. So once the LEED certification is given to the property, it's not going to be reviewed yearly. If that person loses their certification for some reason, they will still maintain that exemption for the 10 years.
Okay, and that brings me to the second question. I know y'all have answered this one.
John wanted to make a clarification. Can he do that?
That's exactly right, but that's how the state law is. That's just how it
right,
is.
Sure.
That's not an option we can change.
That's
but you're
okay.
Absolutely right.
I'm just trying to figure this out. And the other one has to do with LEED certification. We all know how long it takes, but there's some language in here that it sounded to me as though the exemption would be, in essence, retroactive to the date of the completion of the building because it talks about certification. Okay, help me out here because it sounded to me like when the property is finished, that's when the LEED certification exemption would begin. So even if it took them a year to get certification, then would it be retroactive? That's what I'm trying to figure out. Am I making sense to anybody here?
Well, I don't know if retroactive is right because we would value it at its completion. So it may take someone a year to build something. It's not going to have the value until it's complete. So
when does it get the certification? At the moment it's complete or after the paperwork for LEED certification has been sent back from the standards agency?
That I don't know. I would assume once the paperwork goes back.
And my understanding is that can take a few months at least. I'm just trying to figure out when it would start. Would it start when the building was finished? Would it start when the LEED certification was okayed? And if it started when it was okayed, then there's language in this that seems to indicate that it starts when the building's complete. So I wanted to reconcile those two things. The reason that I seconded the motion to send it back was I had heard some talk about neighborhoods, and now y'all are talking about possibly including or going over some language for neighborhoods. If we've got to do that, please let's send it back to committee. If not, okay, I'm okay with it. I think this is good. The intention is good. And I think that for the amount that it'll affect us, it's not a bad thing. I just want to clean it up first.
On the motion to send it back to committee, Nathan.
Yes, I would like to urge my colleagues not to send this back to committee. The two changes that Carol talked about, which are the only changes, are friendly to me, and I was the mover, and Carol was the seconder. So if she's friendly with it as well, then we'll be able to not even have to have an amendment. We can just pass the actual resolution once it's both friendly to both of us.
Julie Kiefer.
Lou Durland used the word achieve in Section 1 also. He replaced the word meet with achieve. That seemed important to him because he used it in both Section 1 and Section 2. That's one comment. The other comment is that the way we have Section 2 worded, or Section 1 says it also, the newly constructed or renovated portion of buildings, and that's plural, and the new LEED neighborhood standards applies to multiple buildings. So in theory, this is covered by that. So I don't think we have to talk about the neighborhood section. There are a lot of things that are changing in LEED certification. It's a moving target. And that's why saying what's ever in effect the time that construction is completed, that's what they'll have to meet. That's the best we can do to define what we think we're doing to comply with state law. I don't think it needs to go back to committee. But if you like the change in Section 2 to the word achieve, then you should have it in Section 1 also.
Carol?
Yeah, it's friendly.
Carol?
Oh, yeah. I think some of the confusion on this that people really need to understand is what it means to get LEED certification. LEED certification is not something that you get just by adding a water heater. Yeah. It's a much more complicated process that involves how you build, what kind of materials you use, whether they're clean for the in the long range, even when the building gets taken apart and thrown away, what they will do to the earth, how you recycle the older materials. You get inspected during the construction. So that's why it's not something that you can just get the certification and then sell your water heater. It doesn't work that way, although I would assume that there are elements that one could do that with. If you really needed to get technical, you know, there's wording changes you could make.
Yeah, talking about whether we're going to return this to committee.
I don't think that we need to, and I think that that the concerns expressed are covered by the
Martha,
fact that it's
then,
a process.
Martha,
not
then
a,
Jim?
An item.
I think if the neighborhood issue becomes more clear and more relevant, we can always amend this. I think this is one step at a time, and it's ready to go.
Jim Dennis?
I would like to call the question on returning it to the committee.
There's a second by Brian. So, therefore, we will vote on whether to call the question on the motion to return to committee. Those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
In favor of returning it to
calling
what?
The question?
This is on calling the question, folks.
Oh.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I guess. No, we're lacking one, so.
Well, two.
Unanimous, but two. Okay, so on the question is whether to return this to committee. All those in favor of returning it to committee, please raise your hand.
Aye.
That's two. Those opposed? That's the rest of us. That fails. All right, now we're back to the local law. Is someone proposing a change to the local law? Carol?
Well, I'm not sure whether to propose this or not. On line 9 of the resolution itself.
Yeah. These were the things that you talked about before.
Yeah, I think those were those already accepted
no,
as friendly?
No, because we hadn't got to that point in the meeting.
Yeah. Oh,
so they are
sure,
friendly
yes.
with the achieve language, yes.
All right. Are they friendly to the seconder?
It's friendly to me.
We're ready to vote.
Okay.
Would you read everything, please?
Thank you.
Section 1. It is the intent of this local law to provide an exemption from county real property taxes for newly constructed or the renovated portion of buildings that achieve LEED certification. Section 2, an exemption shall be granted from county tax purposes based on the scale below for projects that achieve LEED certification in effect at the time, and the rest of the paragraph remains the same.
Okay. Is there anything else? Are we ready to vote on this?
Was that both achieves?
That was both achieves, but I thought I heard Carol say to take out the words according to, and I think that you need those in there to say which standards you're talking about.
Okay, could you read the sentence again? Sorry.
An exemption shall be granted from county tax purposes based upon the scale below for projects that achieve LEED certification in effect at the time of completion of construction or renovation.
Yeah, that does take that out.
It shouldn't. It should say according to the standards that are in effect. I understand he took it out in Section 1, but I don't think you can take it out in Section 2 and have it make sense.
For projects that achieve LEED certification in effect at the time, the word certification.
According to the standards that are in effect at the time. I think you need that language.
I would consider that friendly in addition.
Wait, I don't understand.
Somebody read the whole thing.
Okay, I guess we're going to have it, if that's being proposed as friendly, then we're going to have to have it reread.
Yes, please.
Do you know what they're saying?
I think so. An exemption shall be granted from county tax purposes based upon the scale below for projects that achieve LEED certification according to the standards in effect at the time of completion of construction or renovation.
Yeah. Sure.
Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay. Are we ready to vote on the local law? All those in favor of adopting the local law, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. We will now take a 10-minute break. Be back in your seats by 8 o'clock, and we'll go through the committee reports, and then we'll have our executive session.
Double checking the calendar item.
Thank you.
We're having lunch on Thursday.
Fast as that week. Let's get going, folks. Let's start right down the list. The Workforce Diversity Inclusion Committee, Leslie McBean Claiborne, Chair.
Right, as soon as I bite my brownie. WDSU will meet next Wednesday. In the meantime, we continue to visit with departments and roll out and educate, take questions, and discuss our diversity policy. Today we met with Office for the Aging, and very soon we will be meeting with Solid Waste Division in the Planning Department. That has been going very, very, very well. We're recognizing that a common theme amongst all our employees and within the departments we speak to has to do with communication and making sure that everyone is getting information, and not just this is what you do, but people are looking for more. Why are we doing what we're doing? So when we put things in place throughout county government, regardless of what it is, it's important to our employees that they understand the why. This week, I think, is registration week for the reading and discussion group that is sponsored by Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, the program for which we were fortunate to get a community foundation capacity building grant. We're happy for that, so we're encouraging department heads, we're encouraging employees to please sign up to participate. It's 4 sessions, once a week, 2 hours. Jonathan can attest, he participated last year, that it was worth the time. Right, Jonathan?
No, it's definitely worth the time. And, so far we've had a bunch of people sign up, and it's limited to 15. So
right,
if you want
I was just
in,
about to
in,
say, only 15 can participate. So we're looking forward to this other aspect of the work that we're doing. Thank you.
That's really great, Leslin. Questions for Leslin? Okay. Folks want to go home. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Kathy Luz Herrera, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, the family health emergency that took me out of town and made me late tonight also meant that I missed the meeting. Lucky for me, David McKenna ably chaired the meeting in my absence, and I'd like to ask if he'd be willing to make the meeting report.
Certainly. Committee met on Monday, the 17th,
at 10:30, and we passed resolutions, three resolutions to do with the new facility for us. Final payment for general construction, electrical construction, and mechanical work. And we also passed a resolution for award of bid for municipal solid waste and construction and demolition materials to New England Waste Services of New York, which is a Casella-owned company and has headquarters in Ithaca at 798 Cascadilla Street. And the final thing that we did was authorized construction bidding for the Game Farm Road Bridge. Design and preferred design alternative for the Waterbury Road Bridge, which the committee chose. Actually, it was the more expensive option, which aesthetically was a lot more pleasing, and it's also a two-lane bridge. The third one that we did was we asked for an RFP for design for the Mallory Road Bridge and the Groton City Road Bridge. And that's it. And I believe Ms. Chuck has some
questions for Dave. Carol, did you want to bring something up at this point?
I wanted to bring up something that sort of came up for me coming out of that meeting that I think spans the interests of several committees. So is this...
We'll put it on unfinished business at the end.
No, I think that now is a good time.
Right,
it came out of the discussion about these bridges.
Go ahead.
So realize that what we did was approve going ahead to a preferred design on the Waterburg Road Bridge, and this was a committee-only decision, that essentially it was $104,000 more than a one-lane bridge, and agreed to go ahead with two other bridges. We've got a fourth bridge in the same vicinity as one of those other two that is on our current preferred bridges list with for funding by the state that we're waiting to hear about, and it doesn't look good. And so coming out of this meeting, and I wanted to bring the whole discussion about which bridges we should approve and how here, and the committee didn't want to do that. And I realized that what our committee process calls for at F&I is to approve each bridge project or road project or facilities project separately. It's not a place where we do planning. Yet the planning committee is not a place where we do highway planning. This body used to have a commissioner, a field position. We still have a position on our books that's a commissioner of public works. And for a long time we had a person, the one person who was the joint commissioner of public works and commissioner of planning. So in that era we stepped back and did a little bit more thinking about what's our policy related to upkeep of roads. Do we keep them all to the number 10, you know, a 10 standard and bridges? And so it's been a long time since we formulated a policy, and we've since been affected by the economy. We now are facing the tax cap. The tax freeze has now come up since we put dollars into the capital plan a year ago. We've got new challenges. And in the absence of discussion about what our bridge policy is, we have a de facto policy that says that every bridge needs rebuilding, and every rebuilt bridge is built to the two-lane standard, because we've hired a highway department that is really effective, professional. They do a great job, and their job is to maintain our roads and bridges, and to do a good job doing that. And so that's what they come back to us and say, to do the best job and have every bridge be a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. Here's what you do. You make a two-lane bridge. You build them all. You keep them all open. So we've got this this changed structure that we had with the commissioner. We've got a changed climate. So the other thing that changed is we used to have money that you would get for most of these projects from the, it was federal money, and some of it's federal money that gets decided by and allocated by the state, and there's less and less of that. And after yesterday's meeting, I heard that we're not going to be ever getting the Red Mill Road Bridge money, that's sort of going to be off the list now. That federal and state policy, that's where things are right now, is reduced money for infrastructure. But you hear conversation periodically that tide might change. I mean, I would predict that within the next decade, we'll hear about a new infrastructure project at either federal or state levels. We're going to have to. After we hear about the next few places where bridges collapsed and vehicles fell into much bigger creeks than ours, we may see some changes. So it might make sense. In the meantime, we've got these three bridges that yesterday we just sent along at some stage of the way, three bridges, and there's a fourth pending. It's like about $1 million each. And we chose to spend $104,000 more on one of them than we needed to spend. And we did that in the context of these changes, and ignoring sort of or not having a context to put to discuss changes we've made in our thinking about development focus areas, where should development happen in certain more concentrated areas, traffic calming. We've had come to us big crowds of people upset about us spending $17,000 more on a road project for coloring of shoulders because they want their section of road, they're begging to have their sections of roads upgraded. And in this case, in one of these bridges case, we had a bunch of residents who live in that little hamlet saying we want a one-lane bridge. We don't want a two-lane bridge. We had a town supervisor saying he preferred to have a wider bridge. So we did that. But we don't have any way to step back and say, do we want to do we want to do all three of these bridges? We decided each one individually. I don't know how to deal with this, but I know it was very unsatisfying, and the discussion was unsatisfying in terms of bringing it here, because it would have been bringing each one separately here to talk about.
Thank you for your
points. So I'd like to find a way to deal with this and maybe to refer it to our planning commissioner to think about if he's the right person.
I've got Kathy, and I've got Jim, and I got Joe, and then Dooley.
Great. I didn't take note of all your points, but I do want to speak to some of them. First of all, about the decisions yesterday, if I had been there, I probably would have lost the vote on at least one of those. It would have been a 3-2 vote. I hate to lose, but it happens. And the fact is our committee system is set up so that people pay attention to certain aspects of a subject, and they learn as much as they can about it. And within the scope of those decisions, we go ahead and listen to staff and make the best decisions we can. And we use majority rules voting. I know it may feel unsatisfactory, and I know there's been times when I certainly had sour grapes about it. And I believe that there are necessarily sometimes when we need to re-examine policy. If there was a reason to re-examine this, it could probably go to GO, but I want to caution everybody that if we did, we'd be fundamentally undermining the committee process, because what we have works pretty well. Not everybody gets their way all the time, but what we do have is a situation where the people are, I won't use the word subject matter experts, but we listen to the subject matter experts, and we study and read up on it, and we make the best, most fiscally conscious decisions we can. Having said that, with reference to actual roads and bridges, y'all know I haven't been back on facilities and infrastructure except for this year after a long absence. And yet, being in construction, I do pay attention to roads and bridges, although they're not my favorite. I like buildings a lot. But the fact is, for county, it's about roads and bridges, and our infrastructure is failing. There's no mistake about that. It's not just we up and decided one day that we had to bring everything up to an A. Our infrastructure's failing. The lack of maintaining it for a couple of decades is showing, and we do have some significant outlays to make. I appreciate the decision process that the committee went through, and I know that sometimes you'd like to spend less money. I know that there were members of the public that were concerned about aspects of the bridge, and what I liked and what I applaud Jeff Smith for, our highway director of highway, is that he listened to the concerns of the people, and instead of straightening out the road and making it a two-lane bridge, which is what more or less, I'm taking shorthand here, the original proposal was, after listening, it was decided that straightening out the road would serve as enough of a traffic calming measure that you could bring the bridge up to standard, which is two lanes. So as much as some of us like the quaint one-lane bridge, and as much as many of the people that live on that bridge might have appreciated it to stay that way, this compromise was arrived at, and it was voted on by the majority of the committee. So I'm okay with that. I think that there are times when people want to go a little farther with it. I think that it needs to be respected that having things go through committee saves everybody time, it saves the staff time, and that when someone has a genuine need for a change, it's appropriate to take it to GO or some other place. So if there was going to be a change in policy, I would heartily recommend it going to another committee, but I certainly wouldn't support a change in the policy of having committees make some decisions on their own. The Personnel Committee does it. Health and Human Services Committee does it. Every committee has certain expenditures within their purview. And I think that with some tweaking through the years, it's been appropriate. If this is one that needs to be tweaked, go for it. But you won't get my yes vote.
Jim Dennis.
Kathy, you weren't there, but thank you very much for what you just said. What I'm going to say is that I don't believe the policy is broken. I think the policy has worked quite well for a number of years. We have a capital budget that has all of these things in it well in advance of the time that they actually are done. I think the department that has done the due diligence on this, and the reason, and I'll just say to the rest of the legislature, this bridge is in my area, and the question was one lane versus two lane. The highway superintendent, one of the representatives, or at least two of the representatives, myself, support, and one of the reps lives in the neighborhood, the two lane concept. And mainly because they were concerned about all the other property, all the other roads leading into the two lane. The reason why the bridge cost $107,000, no, it's actually not that much more. It's around $87,000, was it has a concrete facing on it, and it will look very nearly like the old bridge. And that was an issue in the neighborhood, that they wanted to keep the bridge looking the same way. And that's what we're recommending out of the committee. I think the policy, I agree with Kathy. If you can look at all these policies. The budget committee does things, the health committee does things, and it's done at the committee level, and that's what keeps the operation moving along as smoothly as it is. I would suggest that we could look at it at some time, but I think it's working quite well the way it is now, especially in the facilities committee.
And Joe, then Dooley, then Peter.
And Kathy Lewis and Jim have said much of what I was going to say, but I did want to speak to Carol's point about a planning process. And I do want to remind the legislature that we took many months over the course of last year to update our 20-year capital improvement plan. And in that updated capital improvement plan, all of the bridges that we're talking about today were referenced in there, included in that long-term 20-year capital improvement plan that was headed up by Ed Marks with assistance from Jeff Smith and others. So these are, this has gone through the rigor of a planning process. And then when it comes time to figure out the exact details of it, it's a part of the capital budget. And you look at each one of these bridges with respect to one or two lanes, not by policy, but you look at them by the situation that presents in that case. And that's what we have done in the case of all of these bridges. So I don't want anyone to think that these just happened. They are the product of a long planning process that included a comprehensive look at our capital plan last year.
Thank you. Dooley.
Thanks. I visited the F&I committee meeting because of what was on the agenda. I was interested in the solid waste bid, and I was interested in the bridges because I had spent a number of consecutive years on F&I. And some of them have been discussed during my tenure. They all had. What Carol said initially was that we don't have a policy, and that, I believe, is a correct statement. We have a policy with respect to road shoulders, but we don't have a policy with respect to bridges, one lane or two lane-ness. And we have a highway director who sees his job as, I think Carol said, as keeping bridges and roads in good repair, as good as possible. We can't afford to keep them all in tip-top shape, so there's a winnowing process where you look at how many vehicles a day use different parts of our infrastructure, and you look at how bad things are and choose accordingly what you can fix each year. Because something is listed in the capital program, does not mean it has been approved. It goes through a process to get that project actually underway. And that's what I think was happening at F&I. We have a policy on road shoulders which says, and that was argued out years ago. I was involved in that. It was when Ward Hungerford was the highway manager and we had a public works commissioner. And the decision then was to aim for the standards. Our policy is to meet 4 or 5 foot shoulders, whatever it is now. But in any case, every decision would be made on a case-by-case basis. And we do not have a similar policy statement for bridges. And I think that it doesn't take a lot of energy to come up with a policy statement that says, similarly, with bridges, we will decide each on a case-by-case basis. We will try to meet standards, but, and that's what we did with Forest Home, which is had strong town input. I think that that's what's missing, and I don't think it takes a long time to develop that policy. I think I just stated it. With respect to these specific bridges, I look at the Groton City Road Bridge, and there, that served what was once a promising, bustling center where there was some industry, mills, there was some, and there were residences. It is not, the development did not continue. The industry has gone away. The bridge in question serves minimal number of people and a church, as I recall. And it's not at all clear to me that that is a bridge that needs to be replaced. So from a highway director's point of view, if you have a bridge, if you have a road, you keep them up. You always keep them up. You never get rid of any of them. From a legislator's point of view, looking at the resources we have and trying to see how development is taking place in the county, you can decide that maybe a bridge doesn't need to be replaced, like Red Mill or Groton City. So I was not very happy with the way the discussion went at F&I because it didn't get into the meat of the question, which I think Carol was trying to raise in a somewhat different way than I was thinking about it. So I think it's a legitimate question to have come to the legislature. And if the legislature agrees that we should have a policy, and it doesn't necessarily have to say that everything we have has to always be kept up and replaced, that sometimes we can close something and that makes the most sense, then that's what we should do. We should direct F&I or GO to come up with a proposed policy, and as a legislature, we should discuss it and not just leave a series of ad hoc decisions up to the F&I committee, which does the best it can with what it has. And it matters a lot who's on which committee, what decisions get made.
I have three more speakers, and then I kind of like to wrap this discussion up.
Can I ask that my remarks get summarized in the minutes, please?
You certainly can. Peter Stein.
I was a part of that meeting, and I went in there thinking I probably would vote for the one-lane bridge and then voted for the two-lane bridge based on what I heard and the way I think about these things. So a couple of things. One is, if we got rid of the committees making any decisions whatsoever and everything had to be brought to this legislature, we wouldn't get home till 3 o'clock in the morning. Number two, I think that some committees, committees differ from each other. And in my limited experience, I've probably been on half of the committees that are here. The F&I committee mostly votes on technical matters. And the balance between the technical matter and the political or judgment about good or bad on the F&I committee, as I say, in my experience, goes much more towards the technical decision. And I have a great deal of respect for for Jeff Smith. He seems solid. He has a different point of view than I have because he's a technical person. He knows what's going on in the country, and he more or less believes that things ought to be standardized. And as far as I'm concerned, 99% of the time, that's the right thing to do. You don't want roads that have got different widths and different this, that, and the other thing. And standardization is, I think, a reasonable way to proceed. And what generally I do on that particular committee that I don't do on other committees is defer to the judgment of the department chair in that case. So I think that if there were any committee that I would give more latitude for the committee to make the final decision. And, of course, we all know it's not final because anyone can bring anything back to the legislature. It would be this committee, F&I. So that's what I have to say. I don't think we need any change. I don't think we need any standards about new policies about what we do about replacing bridges. I think it's fine. The status quo is fine.
Thank you, Peter. Martha?
Well, I guess I would differ a little bit. I think that there are certain criteria for. I think this does seem like an area for a policy. I don't know if that sounds, one lane versus two lane. I don't know if that sounds crazy, but at the end of the day, things get decided on a case by case basis. But I think some guidance about traffic counts, historic nature of the bridge, about the community context, whatever. I can think of a number of criteria. For some, it might not matter at all, and others, it might be more sensitive and more desirable to keep the historic nature of a bridge. I will tell you, $104,000 is not chicken feed. That's a lot of money to spend for an extra lane on a bridge for I don't know how many cars a day. I mean,
288.
All day long in a 24-hour period, that's pretty low traffic count, and that's a lot of money. So I guess I don't want to say that every bridge design has to come to the legislature, but if we discuss and come to a policy that we agree on, that's the guidance that we send to the committee that does then take it forward. One issue, for example, is that whoever's district it happens to be in. So I don't know these two bridges very well. But I'm sure thinking about Freeze Road Bridge, which is in my district, and it's a one-lane bridge right now. And, you know, I'm going to care a bit when that one comes up. So I think there's there are reasons to go through making a policy on this, and I guess I would encourage that we do that.
Dave McKenna.
Thank you. Just a couple of comments. One of the things that Jeff said, okay, I'm not going to try to steal his words, is that we're not designing this bridge for today. We don't really know what traffic is going to be like, what equipment size is going to be like 30, 40, 50 years in the future. I mean, the bridge that's there now is something like 60 years old or 70 years old and totally inadequate for today's machinery. I would submit that decisions on these things are made on a case-by-case basis, whether it's by the committee, by Jeff, or a combination. Okay. The other thing that affects how things are done is the type of funding. There's some types of funding that support single-lane bridges. There's other types that support conventional bridges. And the traffic count was from 2008. Okay. So I don't know what the traffic count really is today. Thank you.
When it's appropriate, I just want to make closing.
Real short.
Okay, if this is the last thing. As you can tell, F&I committee meetings are very exciting. Our next committee meeting is going to be April 21st at 10:30, and not just this sort of discussion, but many other worthwhile and scintillating topics come up. So I urge the public and any other legislator or staff member who would like to come share the fun to please attend. Thank you.
I had my hand up.
I thought we were just ending that discussion.
Oh, well, I did have, when you said there are three more who had their hand up and then we went to two, I thought you still had me.
It was Peter, Martha, and Dave. You want?
I thought you nodded at me. I would like to just the opportunity to clarify one point.
Can you just give me just one second
on
something else? Brian, if you want to go vote, do you want to do your committee next?
Yeah, but I wouldn't make it.
You wouldn't make it? Go ahead. Carol, real short, please.
I just wanted to clarify that I was not suggesting that the policy come to the planning committee. I was suggesting that we do what we did before and ask Ed, our planner, to step up and help the F&I come up with a policy. That's all.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on to the Economic Development Committee. Will Burbank, Chair.
The Economic Development Committee has not met since our last meeting, but we will be meeting on the 7th of April, and that concludes my report.
Questions for Will? Government Operations. Nathan.
The Government Operations Committee will be meeting next Tuesday at 5:30. And we have a very full agenda, including updates about from the broadband committee to talking about some of our policies related to, or not policies, but procedures related to public comment, to other assorted updates. So we will convene then.
Thank you. Questions for Nathan? Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Carol Chalk, Chair.
We will meet tomorrow. March 19th, and we were going to meet at an unusual time, which is 5:30 p.m. over at the old jail. And we have highlights of the agenda. We have some fairly routine stuff from ITCTC. We're going to talk once again about changing the date and the time of the meeting, so bring your calendars. We have two very interesting presentations, one on the county hazard mitigation plan from Scott Doyle, and one following up on the discussion we had last time about housing trends and the questions that were raised. We're going to have a presentation from Paul Mazzarella on what he has found. He had done a presentation recently for the city of Ithaca,
that I had heard about, and we asked him to come and do it for us. So that should be at about 6. Those two presentations will happen in some order.
Questions for Carol?
Oh, I could also just announce that I know the Solar Tompkins program has hired a program director or coordinator, is the title of the position. Melissa, I would have to look for it. If you're interested, I will look and have to get back to you here.
Will she be coming to your committee?
No, she hasn't started yet.
Can we go back to that?
Unless I can find it right now. No, I'll have to look it up.
Charter Review Committee did meet, and we launched into review of the charter. We had hoped to get through 4 sections. We got through 2, so that gives you an idea. Actually, it's a process that lets us think a little bit about what we do at the county. We go through definitions. We're going through the basic setup of the county. The legislature will be getting into the administration next time, and an assessment. The old library committee. I'm sorry, Will.
So, how many chapters are there?
30-some.
So you got some work ahead. And are there any issues that are emerging, or you think it's pretty much cut and dried in terms of
Are we going to be able to make it? So actually, we are talking about whether we should meet more than once a month. We haven't decided. At this point, we're staying at one meeting a month, but we may have to advance that schedule. Yeah. We haven't run into anything really serious. We kicked around some thoughts about should the legislature consider doing things like having staggered terms or being elected differently than geographic areas. That was brought up. I don't think we really got into any of that very seriously, but it was something we spent a little time on.
Okay, thank you.
The old library committee will be meeting soon, and you expect a contact from Kathy Covert about a date, so we can do that, since we want to make sure we have our process in place so that we can start eventually looking at the RFEIs when they come to us. Martha?
You're going to poll us? Okay.
Just going to dictate. You know. Yes, we'll poll people.
Thank you.
Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis, Chair.
Thank you, Michael. We will be meeting on the 24th of March. The two most important items will be the jail renovation bonding resolution and the human service day reporting bonding resolution. And that's my report. Thank you.
Questions for Jim Dooley?
Jim, did you get any indication from the architect that there would be any alternative plans presented at your committee?
I frankly didn't talk to the architect just to say thanks for coming. No, I didn't.
I'll cover that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else for Jim? Brian Robinson, Public Safety Committee, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Public Safety Committee met just prior to this meeting today. We did hear a report from the co-chairs of the ATI task force. And prior to that, let me just say that Leslin and I actually met with these two when they were formulating the membership. If you can recall, the membership of that committee originally started out as 6 members from various ATI programs and 2 members of the public, and it ended up being 8 members, which included one, I think the difference was a couple of judges, Judge Raleigh and Mark Dresser, who is a local town court judge, yes. That's what I wanted to say. And also there are 4 members of the public instead of 2. So the committee has grown. They have met. I think all but one person was able to meet at their organizational meeting. They know the task at hand, and they seem very enthusiastic about delving into it. At our meeting, the majority of it was spent with two presentations, one obviously for the jail reconfiguration and also the build-out of the DSS. Many of you were there for parts, if not all of it. If you happen to miss it, the same representative from Labella will be here on the 24th at the Budget Committee meeting, which is at 4 o'clock. And they're also coming to the next legislature meeting on April 1st. The plan is for there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of
controversy.
There you go. With the first plan at the DSS building, they reporting, and that bond resolution will go as it was originally scheduled on that same day, the April 1st. There were questions relative to the jail renovation project that were voiced today. The gentleman from Labella heard those. I had a real brief discussion with him today as he was leaving. He also heard those and is going to prepare to come back to make some adjustments, especially as it pertains to line of sight type stuff. One thing that did come out of that meeting, which I hope everybody heard, was that there was some speculation that by converting the one room into dormitory space, that there would no longer be an inside space to do to kind of substitute for times when you couldn't go outside, and that turns out not to be the case. That there is alternate space, same size space that can be used for those few days when they're not able to go outside, as the State Commission wants people outside. I think Captain Bunch said last year there were 25 days. A lot of those had to do with rain, and if you have a shelter over you, you know, that wouldn't even be the case. So we're talking about very few days probably that it would be impossible to go outside, and there actually is space inside the jail for that. But again, those are all points that were made during the presentation, and there's going to be two more of those for additional questions. So,
questions for Brian. Martha?
So sort of an answer to Dooley's question, I think. So, do you think those presentations will be iterative? I mean, you think Mark will try to bring something back to the next meeting that looks a little different?
Yes, as it pertains to the outdoor shelter, yes. He did tell me, just so you know, he did tell me that State Commission of Corrections mandated that particular block structure and not fences. That would no longer meet. You can ask him when he comes back. He told me that he is looking at things like instead of entirely block, secure windows in it. And if you can recall, I asked him, why can't you just move the fence out a little bit on the left-hand side? And go out? And that happens to be right where the tower is. So that's not possible. But what I just told you, make sure and ask him that next day, because he seemed to, but he did hear the concerns, and he will be prepared for some modifications and hopefully maybe even some price adjustments as it pertains to those.
And I would hope maybe the commission, you know, if we have an opportunity to go back to them and say, here's something that we prefer for various reasons.
If it's something along the lines of those, as long as they're, and I'm looking, again, I'm looking for the word, secure windows, then, you know, as long as they meet their standards, they're not going to have a problem with it.
But you're going to pay more for it.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of, I don't even know what the glass would be. I could guess that it would be, you know, fairly expensive type glass for that, but it would certainly serve the purpose. So, well, we'll see. It's a work in progress. So, Will.
So, Brian, I didn't get a chance to ask any questions during that meeting, but I found it very informative. I continue to be very concerned about the potential for heat in that shell during the summer. I know the architect talked about that there would be venting up at top, but being a concrete structure, being exposed to the sun, I find it hard to imagine that it wouldn't be uncomfortably hot during the heat of the summer. And that with some modifications that are more than just a window, we could actually make it function better. And I came away pretty unhappy with what I was seeing. The other thing that you mentioned, I am glad that we are now talking seriously about doing interior recreational space. Though minimally used, it is actually a requirement of the state. We have to have that. And I am concerned that there be a plan for that alternative room, which is currently got library and table and a variety of other things, conceivably could be made to work. And it's not in the realm of the architect, but Captain Bunce and Ken Lansing presumably can come back and say, here's how we could make it work. And I will be very happy to see that. So.
Okay. Hard telling, not knowing. In relation to your first question, I would think that when it's real hot, you might want to get under there out of the sun, but you don't have to. As you recall, only half of that space is covered. The other half is open and open to the elements and so on and so forth. I don't know if you're talking about a fan or something.
No, I'm sort of going where Martha was suggesting, that maybe essentially something that's more roof but open on the sides, because what we're losing is the ability to get a summer breeze that is literally going to cut out that entire courtyard from any air movement.
Okay.
It'll just get the sun.
And, you know, conversely, they might appreciate that in the winter. So I mean I don't know. These are more questions to ask him. He heard the concerns, and he assures me that he's coming back with, something.
Okay. Anything else for Brian? Thank you, Brian.
Yep.
Health and Human Services Committee, Peter Stein, Chair.
Okay. We met a while ago, weeks ago, and heard a number of presentations, all of which I found sort of interesting, and I'll try to tell you briefly what we talked about. We heard two presentations from COFA, one having to do with the problems that FoodNet has had. FoodNet was in very serious, I guess you know what FoodNet is. FoodNet prepares and delivers food to elderly people. Not only people who are on limited means, anybody who has mobility problems and wants to have food delivered, meals delivered to them, can get it through FoodNet, no matter what their means are. And there were FoodNet essentially went the coast to bankruptcy. The problem was that there was an increase, a substantial increase in the needy customers and the loss of a three-year grant. And FoodNet is supposed to be able to subsidize the meals of needy people by charging people who can afford to pay for them more than they charge the needy people. or essentially to make a profit off of those meals to, in order to provide meals for needy people. They made a one-person reduction in staff and other small changes and have fixed the problem, and they are now on a sustainable basis economically. A serious problem is the PERS machines. For those of you who don't know, those are machines that elderly people wear, which somehow gives off an alarm to the 911 center when they fall down. And the problems they're having there are with technology, that the PERS system was built probably more than I remember when it was built. It's about 15 years ago it was made. And the technology that they use, namely transmission over telephone lines, is no longer the preferred technology. And it turns out that one can also get PERS-type coverage from cell phone providers. And the price of them is less than what it costs PERS to keep maintaining their system. So they have a problem. And I asked, well, why not just let people buy their own thing if they can buy it cheaper than we provide it, as long as the person is covered? Well, there are problems. Some of the systems really don't cover very well. And the other problem is the same as for FoodNet, namely that the instruments for people with lower means is provided for by the people that spend more money on it. So anyway, they're planning to attack this problem head on and try to see if there isn't something that we can do with the current technology that can do what we have been doing for 15 years. We heard a presentation from Patricia Carey on child welfare, which I found extremely interesting. She gave a lengthy, detailed description of the process that ends up in a child being taken away from their family, being taken away from their mother and father, their immediate family. And we've heard certain people give public presentations having to do with that problem, so I found this very interesting. And it's a long procedure. It ain't easy to take away a child from their immediate family. It requires several house visits, several reports on why it is that the child is endangered and should be taken away, and also there has to be a decision by a judge before DSS can do that. We heard a presentation from Sue Romanchek about the closing of the psych centers, which we've all heard about before. The closing of the psych centers has put serious has given rise to serious problems of overcrowding by the psych centers that remain. The state has promised to put money back into the system to take care of those problems, but it's not clear exactly what form this state money will take. It may be the services of staff, or it may be money. And given the lack of clarity about what the state is willing to do, it's very difficult for them to plan how to keep up with this. And the last thing we heard was a youth profile by the youth department, which was extremely extensive, talking about what are the profiles of youth inside within the county. There was a whole lot of things there, but there were, you know, lots and lots of charts, and I couldn't absorb them all. But there were two that really surprised me. One is the municipality in Tompkins County who have the most number of youth is Dryden. I can't imagine why that's true, but anyway, apparently, well, you're nodding, so you're not surprised to hear that.
We have a lot of mobile home parks.
The what?
We have a lot of mobile home parks.
Mobile home parks, okay. I did see one fact that I found rather surprising, and we didn't really have an explanation for it. It turns out that if you look at the percentage of the children in our county who are in foster care and compare that to the percentage of children in foster care in New York minus New York City, okay, the counties that don't include New York City, our value is twice the average in New York State. So I have requested to see some more information on that and try to understand why that's true. That's my report.
Thank you, Peter. Questions, Martha?
I thought Elmira Psych Center was staying open, and
yes,
at the Greater Binghamton Center as well. So are you
not Elmira? Greater Binghamton.
I thought Elmira was also staying open.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I thought, Martha, you were correct. I think they're shutting down units in both of those, so there'll be fewer beds in both of them.
There's certainly a few of us, but I must have heard wrong. That's what I thought I heard, that Elmira was being shut down. But no, Binghamton will be open. Yeah.
Were you also talking about closures in other parts of the state?
Other parts of the state.
Affecting.
Yeah. I mean, they got to do something in Hamilton County with their people that need to go into psych centers.
Okay. Other questions for Peter? We take the minutes of Tuesday, March 4th.
Oh, I forgot to give my big announcement. I'm sorry. Our next meeting will be April 8th at 3:30.
We have a motion on the minutes. Is there a second? Seconded by Brian. Discussion? Those in favor of the minutes, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? One opposed. Gentlemen, Milton and Stanley, you've come in. In the past, we understand your work schedule. Is there something you wanted to say to us? Or just, you'd have to go to the microphone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to know what is on the agenda, far as what has been done and how will the living wage budget, will more be put in the contingency fund? Will there be an enforcer to make sure that the companies follow the rules as the order comes down, make sure that this is not all in vain. And so we're here to make sure that an enforcer do be a part so that we will know the companies that's under the radar and those that's over the radar. About the living wage. Also, what more can be done? Thank you very much.
Joe, do you want to mention what's happening with the contracts?
Yeah, I could, and we're due to report back to GO, I think, your next meeting, and then by agreement last year, we're also due back mid-year to talk about do we want to take another run at the policy, because the policy last time was agreed. We'd hold off on any policy changes last year. While we took a year to basically take a hard look at the contracts that are coming through the process to see who pays, who doesn't pay, how far from the mark they are, get a really good sense of exactly what our situation is, and in the process of that, identifying that maybe there are contracts that are either very close to being able to pay the living wage, maybe there are circumstances that would warrant the county providing additional funding. The legislature set aside $100,000. So that's very much a part of the process, too, as we look for contracts like that that seem to lend themselves to that kind of supplemental funding. So I'm due to report to GO, I think, next Tuesday on status of current contracts.
Thank you. Carol?
Can I have to ask a couple of questions? One is I just wanted to ask that my comments about bridge policy be included with the minutes. Right. And then I did find the name of the woman. The Solar Tompkins people were very excited to find this woman, and hopefully we'll have the chance to meet her. Her name is Melissa Kemp. She's held prior positions with three different local-level companies installing and designing and installing residential and commercial solar electric, solar domestic hot water, and geothermal systems. She's taught at TC3, developing several series of classes on solar electric and geothermal systems for the TC3 Green Technology Program, and holds certifications in all four different organizations in the field, and further has been involved in public outreach campaigns. So she was sort of their ideal candidate, and I hope we have the chance to meet her, Melissa Kemp.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folks, we need an executive session tonight to talk about labor negotiations. I have a motion by Brian. Is there a second? Seconded by Martha. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? We will go into executive session. When we come out, we do not expect to take any action. So we'll give a few minutes for the cameras to get shut down.